This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury telling you that there is no better time to buy a vehicle than right now. During the Lincoln Mercury Signature Sales Event, simply...
Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Back surgery, weight loss surgery, cardiac care, incredibly complex medicine made easy to understand, thanks to the DMC. Join Emery King at DMC.org to see why, when it's serious, go to Detroit. Check out the DMC videos today at DMC.org.
Got It Made from Theory of a Dead Man. Over the course of the last hour or so, we've been speaking to Tyler Connolly, Dean Back, and David Brenner from Theory of a Dead Man, whose scars and souvenirs will be in stores this Tuesday, April Fool's Day. Appreciate you guys coming by. What is coming up for the rest of 2008 for the band?
Touring, I believe.
Yeah, we'll be on the road.
Non-stop touring. I think we're looking forward to it.
I think we have a headline tour we're doing across America starting very shortly, I think in a couple weeks. And then and then we'll go up to Canada, and I think I'll end around sometime in June. And after that, I don't know, probably start again.
More touring. Yeah, we'll be touring for the next couple of years, hopefully.
Well, appreciate you guys coming in, and again, congratulations on the record. Great job to you and Howard and Chris Lord-Alge.
Thank you so much.
I'm Lou Brutus. You've been listening to Inside Theory of a Dead Man, Scars and Souvenirs. Find it in stores this Tuesday, April Fool's Day. This has been the Theory of a Dead Man Radio Network.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday in Detroit, WRIF. Peter Werby here with you. Jalene Jordan, as usual, joining me. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
And, hey, we got the temperatures out of the 30s. Well, let's not talk about the weather, man. How boring is that? But, I mean, listen, if you're somewhere else in the country, you probably think this is not even worth talking about. If you're here in Michigan and we're talking about weather into the 40s, let alone tomorrow for opening day with the Tigers going to be in the 50s, I mean, we're all...
It's thrilling.
It's thrilling, yeah.
Yeah, it's time to come out of hibernation once again.
Man. Bad winter. Bad winter.
Really bad.
313-298-WRIF. If you're just having to tune by here and you're thinking, why is this guy giving this phone number? It's not for requests, although it's a good request number when we're playing the riff rock and roll. But for these 2 and 3 hours here on WRIF Sunday night, it's a talk show. And we talk about this and that, you and me. Right, there you go.
And a lot of it's pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, there you go. You know, I got two emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That, as I always say, is for the bashful and for when the lines are jammed, which I can't see a phone right now.
We're all good,
yeah. Oh, I see. I got to do a little something over here to get the other screen up. Man, this is all this technology.
I know.
Yeah. But
remember vinyl?
I do.
I do, too.
I do. Anyway, two different, maybe you know, they're like buddies, that said, I never heard such a dumb talk show host, meaning me.
Really?
Yeah, saying...
Did you say they were friends of yours?
No. Just people that wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com saying that, noting that I say so frequently, I don't know, or I don't know what the answer is.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of people, I've said this before, when you tell them you have a political leaning, mostly political talk show, that they think you have all the answers. And, well, you know what? There ain't no way.
Yeah, and I don't trust anybody that says they have all the answers, number one.
Very good.
And you can believe these guys are right-wingers. And all of these right-wing talk show hosts, they make the most egregious factual misstatements over and over and over again. Not opinions. But factual errors. Whole books filled, in fact, people have written with the errors of some of these right-wingers. And, of course, they never go back and say, gee, I made a mistake, that I was wrong about this. Whereas once in a while, I actually do make an error. And I'm eager to come in here and say, look, because I don't want any of you, if I say something as a matter of fact, I don't want any of you then telling somebody else some misinformation.
Right.
So I'm always eager to do that. I don't know why I got off. But we're going to, you know, a couple times with political talk shows like this one and when I do nationally syndicated shows, if I do anything except for what they consider hardcore politics,
right?
Usually it's liberals and leftists. They're saying, I don't know why you bother with that.
I know. Well, when we talk about some other kind of racy issues or crazy things going on, sex scandals, things like that, some people get very angry.
Well, on Christmas Eve, I sat in a national show,
yeah,
and they figured, wait, look, let's get an atheist on the air for Christmas Eve. He's not going to be doing anything. So I did this. I interviewed Tom Flynn from Prometheus Press that had just put out this enormous 800-page encyclopedia of unbelief.
So on Christmas Eve, this is who you have as a guest.
Yeah.
You're so rad.
Well, I thought, you know, I was a little worried because there's a lot of good people that are religious, and you know, there's a lot of bad people, and I would say overwhelmingly that religion has not had a good effect on the world and its population. But I always feel like I might be offending some of these people that do such good work in the world. So I thought I might get some people saying, how dare you insult
I would expect that.
Religion on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
No, it was these people saying, why are you bothering to talk about that?
Really?
That was it. Yeah, these national audiences. All right. So,
finicky.
This was this is a double lead up. A little later, we're going to be talking about the Hash Bash. The Hash Bash is this 37-year-old event that happens on the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor, just about 50 miles southwest of Detroit, where we're broadcasting from. And it's for an end to the drug war, which essentially is a war on the citizens of the United States. And, well, I'm sort of giving it away because it sounds frivolous, like, hey, man, you just want to, you know, get high.
Get together and smoke down.
Yeah. You know, all these people that say, well, we're for medical marijuana. I bet you of all the medical marijuana advocates, of which there's some very, very serious people that understand that it has some medical applications in a number of circumstances.
Certainly.
And people, remember we used to, when we had our nationally syndicated show,
uh-huh,
the woman who ran in Santa...
It was in Santa Cruz. It was a medical marijuana...
Hospice.
Farm type. Of, you know, she grew it there. And,
but it was a hospice.
Right, as well. Yeah.
So here were cancer...
They raided her.
Yeah. This was Ashcroft, which people aren't even remember these names anymore. He was the first attorney general for Bush in 2001. Yeah. Well, we can remember. Yeah, like he lost because he lost the popular vote at a minimum.
Uh-huh.
Maximum, I think he lost the whole election. And Ashcroft lost who became the attorney general, lost the senatorial race in Missouri in 2000 to a dead man.
That's right.
The guy who he's running against.
Who can say that?
Yeah, the guy who he's running against, whose name, because finally, I guess somehow or other, his widow got in. But Ashcroft lost to a dead man, so they made him the attorney general. And then the big loser in Michigan was, we forget all these people. Remember, just he had his first name. Oh, it's almost here. Anyway, he was a senator, and they made him, he lost to a Democrat.
Oh, right,
and they made him the Secretary of Energy. That's why we used to call it the Cabinet of Losers.
Yes.
All right.
We haven't improved.
Right. Spencer Abraham. That was it.
Ah.
Yeah. He had terrible signs. His signs all said Spence.
Oh, I remember those.
And people were clueless. Like, what the hell does Spence mean? But Adam Brook will be our guest. He's been the MC of the Hash Bash for the last several years. And he's going to talk about why the Hash Bash may be shut out of University of Michigan's DIAG, as it's called.
Yeah. The area where it's usually held.
Yeah, it's a diagonal area. And they call it the DIAG.
Is it a conspiracy, or is it...
We'll have to ask. We'll do that about 11:30 Eastern time as well.
Great.
All right. This news that Muslims are now more numerous than Catholics. I give a darn.
I didn't know where you were going, right?
Yeah, I didn't
know
almost either there. Islam has surpassed Roman Catholicism as the world's largest religion, the Vatican newspaper said Sunday. And according to Monsignor Vittorio Formenti, said in an interview with the Vatican newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano, Formenti compiles the Vatican's yearbook, he said, for the first time in history, we are no longer at the top. Muslims have overtaken us.
And he said it in a negative manner?
Well, he said Catholics accounted for 17.4% of the world population, which has remained stable, but Muslims were at almost 20%. Hmm. The Monsignor said, it is true that while Muslim families, as is well known, continue to make a lot of children, Christian ones, on the contrary, tend to have fewer and fewer.
You know...
So, get busy. How many children do you have?
I have none.
You need about five to get us back in the running.
Forget it. You know, I just don't understand how these leaders can be so unchristian-like in the way they speak of each other.
Well, this is a whole right-wing movement about replacement, and I was trying to find, I can't remember what it was. Why do I read things? It was in The Nation magazine. And it was a whole deal about how this, there's a sector of religious whites who are fearful of a darker, non-Christian population taking us over demographically.
Right.
And it was stuff like this, right?
Uh-huh.
So, Christians, hey, at ease. Because
relax.
Because all Christians aren't Catholics, and Christians make up 33% of the world population. Let's hear it for the Christians. Yeah, congratulations. So it's just the Catholics who have kind of pulled. There's such whack jobs around here. One of these right-wing white guys in the Netherlands, a guy named Geert Wilders.
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, you know my love for the Netherlands.
Yeah,
and this is upsetting to me.
Well, it's actually a very, very liberal country.
Right.
Obviously. Amsterdam, the home of John Sinclair.
Yes.
Which will figure in our story about the hash bash when we talk to Adam Brook about it in about 20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
But a Dutch right-wing politician who's actually in the parliament, Geert Wilders, who, among other things, has dyed platinum hair.
Does he?
Yeah.
Wow. How very Netherlandish.
Yeah. So he had this film called, where was it here? What's the name? It was
called Fitna.
Fitna, yeah, which means...
Civil strife.
Civil strife, yeah.
It features news images of beheadings, violence against women in the Islamic world, anti-Semitic tirades.
By Muslims.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
15-minute film was posted on the internet, but it has been taken down because the people, LiveLeak.com, said they were left with no other choice but to remove Fitna from our servers because they had all these threats on their staff. And it even includes that infamous Danish cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad being hit by a bomb. I thought actually it was like his hat was a bomb or something like that.
That created no small stir,
yeah,
too. I'm telling you.
I don't get it. People insult Islam by saying it's a violent religion and then everybody riots?
Right.
And they threaten to kill people?
Yeah.
And they have killed people? I don't get
backwards.
I mean, don't judge Islam too harshly, though. Because all religions do that. They kill their enemies. Think about all the religious wars in Europe the Crusades and the Inquisition and what have you. So you could have made this film about Christians as well or Hindus or what other big ones are there? You couldn't make it about Buddhism. Or could you?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes...
That would just be very un-Buddhist.
Yeah.
Well, like.
Some of these things, of course... When they get in the hands, like Taoism is essentially just a philosophy, but when you get it to be the Taoist religion, then it gets bureaucratic and all of that. So, I don't know. They ought to get over their own selves. And I mean all these religious people. Here's we're on religion. A prominent artist who had run-ins with both the church and state in her native Russia after taking part in a controversial exhibition has disappeared without a trace from her new home in Berlin. And the artist is Anna Mikhailchuk, 52 years old, has been missing for nearly a week. No evidence surfacing up to this point that she's still alive. She left her apartment, Miss Mikhailchuk, who exhibits under the name of Alchuk, took part in an exhibit in 2003, so we're talking 5 years ago, called Caution, Religion. was at a Moscow museum, and the opponents called it blasphemous. Now, this is not Muslims. These are Christians. Shortly after the show opened, six men from an Orthodox church in Moscow ransacked the museum, damaging or destroying many of the works on display. Well, the Muslim chant of God is great, or the Christians talking about God is all-powerful, I mean, do they really think, any of these people think, that if God is so great, if God is so powerful, has all these powers of omnipotence and omniscience and all that, that he's really going to be bothered by somebody saying he doesn't exist, like I would say?
That's a good point.
Or that some image of him.
He would just think of them as the non-believers and pray for them.
Yeah. Well, I don't
know. Something like that.
Who would he pray to?
Himself. I don't know. That's a really good question.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, a little later, when we talked to Adam Brook about the Hash Bash and how it might not happen this year after 37 years, we're going to be playing, I missed this last year, been playing it for about 10 years. There's a band called Burning Incense from the CD.
Great name.
Get Me High. So we'll play their song in a little while. What did someone say, that all we do is, and all we talk about is negative stuff?
Yeah, we get that from time to time.
Finally, all that we're being gouged, and that's an important verb, so we're being, I usually say, looted. Gouged is usually what it said, like at the gas pump. I just saw it.
Yes.
333, which is half of 666.
Oh, yeah, you so overthought that one.
Yeah, I did. But it'll probably be that soon, because we're not doing anything.
Right.
And they look at us, and they say, well, we got it over $3. We got it over $4 in some places, and people are grumbling. And then it'll be up over $5, and they'll see what's happening. Well, they might not get that far, because to protest fuel costs, truckers are planning a nationwide strike. But there's some problems. Dan Little says $4 a gallon diesel fuel and other soaring costs forced him to temporarily halt his cattle hauling business in Missouri several days ago, and he may have persuaded truckers across the country to pull their rigs off the road next week. This is New York Times yesterday. Soon after, Mr. Little posted a rant about his vanishing profits on a website that he runs to help livestock carriers find loads to carry. He started hearing from colleagues in other states promising to join him in a nationwide trucker shutdown on April 1st. Numerous drivers have used their time at home or internet-equipped truck stops this month to spread word of the idea on websites like OvertimeTruckers.com. OvertimeTruckers.com. You go to my website, Peter Werbe. I bet you want to know how to spell that.
I do.
W-E-R-B-E. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and it's all there. The only problem I had with this, and this is very frequent among over-the-road truckers, was their use in their emblem of the Confederate flag. And I think they don't mean it so much, hopefully. In fact, I'm assuming the best that they don't mean this as the sign of racism.
Are you starting this whole
about the flag?
Up again.
Okay, never mind. Forget it. But no.
Get people going.
No, it's a hideous flag. It was the flag of the biggest traitors in American history. Right?
Yes.
That wanted,
I agree with you.
Yeah, that fought.
Every time you even bring it up a little bit, boom, the lines are full.
Yeah, that fought for states' rights, which essentially was fought to maintain other human beings as slaves.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what the state rights.
Yeah.
Mr. Little and other independent truckers, what the industry calls owner-operators, so they are serious about their plans to stop accepting freight on Tuesday. And Mr. Little, as they say here, 49 years old, someone in Washington that's a lot smarter than I am needs to take a look at this industry. If you're losing money going to work, then what's the sense in going to work, he says. We're either going to be broke with our trucks parked, or we're going to be broke out on the highway wearing our trucks out.
Wow. It's kind of like, I remember the Don't Buy Gas Day last spring, I think it was. It was in May, I think, last year.
Yeah.
Where we, there was the big movement, and we had all the naysayers, and one guy said he was going to go get gas and fill up everything in his house, his lawnmower. So, I mean, I just wonder how many people will follow suit. People got to make a buck.
Yeah, but one of the things with gasoline is they know that people are going to have to buy gasoline the next day.
Exactly.
Yeah, fill up. Some people have said we got to target it, like ExxonMobil, which is one of the worst in people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, these people say, no, my Citgo, it comes from Venezuela. No, let's buy it from Saudi Arabia, right? The people that supplied all the 9/11 hijackers.
Yeah.
But here, this could happen. 250 drivers in Georgia plan to form a convoy on Tuesday from Macon to Atlanta before turning off their trucks for at least 3 days, said Sheila Walker, a log hauler who has organized several meetings for local drivers to plan the protest. But it's not getting the kind of support it should. On their website, it says all unions, and that's what we have to talk about. And that's the old industrial workers of the world. That's the reason that the government went after them before World War I. They called for one big union, and their weapon of political action was a general strike. And where that actually happened in like the ninth, I'm forgetting all my history. But after World War I, maybe it was Seattle, but there was like general strikes in Toledo. There were general strikes one or two other places, and Minneapolis. And this is 1930s, and it got the ruler's attention, whereas us complaining doesn't. So I'm not trying to say we shouldn't complain, and this shouldn't be an arena here. What else can it be? On radio is a venue of ideas, but this is what's got to start moving people out into the real world. And 250 those big rigs. Wow.
Yeah, that sounds large.
But David Owen, president of the National Association of Small Trucking Companies, does not support the protests. He says he doubts that it would happen. No.
Well, we'll find out.
Yeah. A lot of people get turned around easily. People often that have views like you and me, people that have views like Barack Obama, who's barely left of center.
He was on The View the other day.
Yeah, I saw that.
Television show.
Yeah.
He's a slick one.
Even that crazed right winger. What's her name? Hasselbeck or something? Or
Elizabeth Hassel. I call her something else, but it's Hasselbeck. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
She's awful.
Yeah, she is.
She is repulsive. And she was just really attacking him, just like a little Yorkie, you know?
Hey.
Biting at your ankles.
I don't have a Yorkie. But,
well, I love Yorkies, but yeah, like a little mean Yorkie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, these right wingers say she's the best looking one on there.
Oh, please. She is. No, her personality and her politics make her the ugliest one on there.
I agree. But the point being is that in other countries, you can have views like ours and you can wind up dead.
Yeah,
right?
That's
you
right.
Can wind up. I mean, like unionists in Colombia are killed regularly by death squads.
Yeah, for unionists like for Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola, yeah. So, I mean, I always wonder. People sometimes say to me, "Oh, you know, we appreciate so much what you're doing, and you're so." People have said to me, "You're so courageous." And I said, "Courageous? Why am I courageous? I'm just saying what I believe."
Well, you're just used to it.
No. Here's what I'm talking about. Is that like I've always been a strong unionist and a strong supporter.
Yes.
My union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and I'm very seriously. I look and when I read about this stuff, and if I knew that I was going to be active in my union and I could be risking my life, would I still be there?
Right.
I don't know.
Good question.
Yeah.
And how courageous are you?
Yeah. These people. All right. So what about just getting arrested? You did not see this one because this just came across. This was in Newsday, at Newsday.com, which must mean it happened on Long Island. It doesn't have a dateline, but it says an 80-year-old church deacon was removed from the Smith Haven Mall yesterday in a wheelchair and arrested by police for refusing to remove a T-shirt protesting the Iraq War. These people.
Yesterday?
Yeah, Saturday. Yeah.
Okay, this was happening here and there when
a few years ago.
But haven't...
Police said that Don Zirkel of Bethpage, I've never heard of that town, was disturbing shoppers at the Lake Grove Mall with his T-shirt, which had what they described as graphic anti-war images. Zirkel, who's a deacon at Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal. I'm sorry. My apologies for laughing. Just a weird name. But that's what I mean about the good religious people. And in Wyandanch, where the hell? Anybody? Yeah, some of you are listening in New York. Give us a shout at 313-298-WRIF. And where are these towns? Out on Long Island? The cops told him, mall security told him to turn his shirt inside out. Zirkel refused to turn his shirt inside out and wouldn't leave. Security placed him on civilian arrest and called police. When police arrived, Zirkel passively resisted attempts to bring him to a police car. Zirkel said he was sitting, but he denies it.
This man.
Yeah, he said he was sitting in a food court drinking coffee with his wife, Marie, 77, and several others when the police and mall security officers approached and demanded they remove their anti-war T-shirts.
Don't these people have anything better to do?
I don't think so.
You know what, Peter? Isn't it amazing? A story like this, when we have a good friend, singer-songwriter, David Rovics, and he wears a picture, a T-shirt, black T-shirt with a picture of Bush on it and says International Terrorist in the airport.
Really?
Yes.
Well, see, he's got more cojones than I do.
Yeah, he's courageous.
I just want to get through that real quickly. But there's more. The other people complied. Man, what a bunch of weasels. Not weasels. What would it be? I'm sorry. Take that back. What a bunch of...
Kind of wussy?
Yeah,
maybe?
Something like that. But yeah. Zirkel said he refused. And when he wouldn't stand up to be removed and arrested, authorities brought over a wheelchair. And Zirkel said, who's a deacon at one of the poorest Catholic parishes on Long Island, where a devastating fire recently destroyed the rectory and storage areas, so they forcibly picked me up, he's 80 years old, and put me in the wheelchair. He was charged with criminal trespassing and resisting arrest, released on bail.
Now, that's criminal.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this is always kind of, you don't know which way this is going. John McEntee, who's a Uniondale commercial litigation lawyer, said that, generally speaking, a mall has the right to control what happens on its property, but that's what they call kind of quasi-public property. You don't have the right to just suspend the Constitution because you've gone to, what's that fancy mall out there? Oakland Mall, that's not the fancy one.
Oh, yeah.
Somerset.
Yes.
Somerset Collection.
It is quite fancy.
Puke.
It's, well, it makes me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right.
Oh, poor Mr. Zirkel.
So I'm saying you might have to risk arrest.
Okay.
Did I say that? Risk arrest. That's easy for you to say.
Every time we go to one of those protests, we do one of the big ones, like in D.C.
Yeah.
But you taught me how to not get arrested at protests.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that was?
Run your ass.
Run.
Yeah, run.
As soon as the tear gas comes out, run.
Yeah, yeah. But that, we haven't been to one where they've... in Miami.
That was horrible. Yeah. And I've been gassed about 3 or 4 times in D.C. now.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Look at me go.
Well, I am going to be speaking. I haven't done any public speaking in a while, but since I went to Cuba on a trip in early February, I was asked by the Sierra Club, the Southeast Michigan group, to come and moderate a discussion. They're showing a new documentary on Cuba called, it's right here in front of me, The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. They were dependent completely on Soviet oil in the 1990s. And so this documentary kind of talks about how they decentralized everything.
Although, are you doing this, Peter?
Oh, that's a good idea to tell you. Yeah, it's Thursday, April 3rd.
It's this Thursday?
Yeah, at the Northwest Unitarian Universalist Church. Church. Hmm. But do you know what they say about Unitarian? Two things about Unitarian. My two Unitarian jokes?
I don't know them.
I bet I do, but it's been a while. The last time they mentioned Jesus Christ in a Unitarian church is when the janitor fell down the basement steps.
Oh, no. I have not heard that.
No? And that's a variation of, I can't remember the comedian. He used to say, Bill Cosby. Yeah, Bill Cosby used to say he thought he was Jesus, his name. He thought his name was Jesus Christ for the first 6 years of his life. Every time his dad would come in the room, he'd say, Jesus Christ, what are you doing?
Right. And what's the other, the other one?
That there are these Unitarian extremists who burn question marks on people's lawns.
That's great.
I like that.
I like that one, too.
All right. So you probably can't get this on the radio, but it's 23925 Northwestern Highway. It's on the service drive around 10 Mile and Evergreen. If you go to my website, I have to do it, folks, because every time some of you say, do you really have to spell your name every time you give your website address?
You should see his mail.
Yeah, and then everybody on the
other. Mr. Worthy.
Yeah. On the other hand, everybody says, I couldn't get your name. So it's Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. .com. And if you go over the left side, there's a little silhouette of the city of Detroit, and that'll give you all the directions and everything like that. So join us. This film, I haven't seen it, but I've heard good things about it, and I will be leading the discussion. And this is like what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. I don't have a tremendous amount of things to say about Cuban environmental stuff, but some. And mostly, though, I'd like to hear from people in the audience. So I'll just be saying, yes, you with the green shirt. You know,
right.
Yeah.
Like and that. Oftentimes when you go, people just really want to talk about what their observations are, and that's great.
All right, we're going to take a break. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, this is a Night Call show on WRIF. Our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Adam Brook about whether or not the Hash Bash is going to be canceled and its importance.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Tigers opening day rocks with the Riff
this Monday.
So leave it to the Riff to give you your best reasons to play hooky.
First, join the Tiger Rock Dunk Hotel starting at 10 a.m. for all your pregame festivities at the Fillmore Detroit. Get live rock from Detroit's own The Mugs and Universal Temple of Divine Power. Plus, the first 101 people through the door will snag a limited edition Riff opening day t-shirt. Then, after the game, join Steve Black at Chili's Chili across from Comerica Park for the Motor City's ultimate post-game party. Sponsored by your Metro Detroit Ford dealers. Big Ford First. Opening day rocks. With 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Change my attempt. Good intentions.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. We were set to talk with Adam Brook, who is the MC of the Hash Bash. This is the largest legalization event in the country, non-advertised, and yet thousands of people show up. But Jalene Jordan just put a call into him, and I guess he's doing something else right now, too.
Hopefully he'll call.
Yeah. So, Adam, we gave you the number.
Give us a call.
Something just flashed through my mind and then flashed out again. But we were talking earlier about that there is a call out for an over-the-road truckers strike on April 1st. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So here's Bill from Monroe. Not Bill Monroe. We were thinking maybe it was Bill Monroe, but he's passed, I think. Bill from Monroe, the home of Fermi II and General George Custer. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
We're doing great.
Hey, my dad's been an over-the-road driver for the last 32 years, and I've never seen it as bad as it's been right now, ever.
Really?
Yep. A lot of it started going downhill after Reagan started the deregulation.
Uh-huh.
He used to get paid, I think it was over a dollar a mile, loaded, unloaded, it didn't matter, but once he done that, it made these other companies cut prices and rates and haul for nothing. If you see I believe it's called OOIDA, the Owner Operators Association.
Yeah, yeah.
They have a lot of stickers you see on the guys that are independent. So say no to cheap freight, which is your Swift, Schneider, J.B. Hunt. They'll haul this stuff for next to nothing. They don't pay the driver as much. The only way a nationwide strike would work is if you got those three big companies. I mean, there's other ones, too. But if you could get those big companies to shut down, it would really work. You'd stop the country.
Sure, you would. In a way, I was just about to say we need the Teamsters, but of course the Teamsters are employees, aren't they?
Right.
Yeah, so they're just driving. At one level, it doesn't matter to them if gas is $7 a gallon. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't like that because they'd have to be paying that for their... but it's not directly affecting their bottom line the way it is you and other owner-operators.
Right, right. Right now, my dad, he gave up over the road. He does, he's working demolition in, of all places, New Orleans.
Yeah, wow.
I've seen some crazy stuff down there where he hauls, you know, they knock these houses down and whatnot, and they have these big roll-off dumpsters. He has 40-yard boxes, containers that they're loading all this stuff in. And when it first happened, they were paying $26 a yard, the government was, FEMA. And by the time it got to him, it was only paying about $7. He was the eighth person to be paid.
Yeah, wow.
All the way through the line.
Well, they're trying to figure out. I mean, this is always the big contest between the owners and the people that work. I mean, you guys are in kind of an unusual position, but people are always trying to reduce their costs. Well, frequently the costs are you and me. I mean, either your small company or just your own truck or the you know those of us that work for a living. And they've got the upper hand at the moment. So that's what I'm always saying, that we need resistance. And I'm really admiring of these truckers who are taking this on. I mean, this could be the first step. Who knows?
Yep. It's the tough part is to get is the big companies. If you could get them to stop, then I mean your UPSs, FedExes, all of that.
Are you in touch at all with these people? Or are you going to take part in it? Can you do it?
I could. I mean, I haven't really. We get all the owner operator magazines, the Overdrive and whatnot.
Yeah.
And they come to the house because, like, say you've been to every truck stop in the world, and you pick these up and then you get on a list and what.
Well, here's the website again. It's called OvertimeTruckers.com, and they're the ones that are calling for this April 1st shutdown of. Owner-operator rigs to protest the cost of fuel. All right. Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate your call.
Yep. You guys have a good night.
Okay.
Yeah.
You too. Now, what happened? Maurice from Detroit, he said he had a theory that was going to blow our mind, and I was going to give him the opportunity. I was going to say, this better blow. I'm going to hang right up on you if this doesn't blow my mind.
And he hung up?
Yeah. So now,
he'll be back.
We were talking about religion kind of negatively. Let's be honest. We were talking about it negatively, not kind of.
Well, from time to time, there's a lot of negativity involved.
Now, here is someone. This is Christian from Sterling Heights. Is that your religion or your name or both?
Both.
Okay.
I've heard this really stupid idea from a few people before. It's saying that they're own Christian. They're saying that Catholicism or Lutheranism or Apostolism or whatever is a totally separate religion from Christianity. And usually my reply to that is, dude, you're an idiot. If you believe Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior, you're Christian. Have you ever heard this before? Because this is a really whacked out idea.
I don't keep up with this stuff very much, I have to tell you. Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe somebody else can run it by us.
Yeah.
But thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for bringing it up. So where's Adam Brooke? I don't get this. Adam, come on, man. He's probably... Never mind. We won't talk about it. Here is both bad news and good news. People that Jillian and I both really admire, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. These are the people that put such an incredible dent in the whaling activities, the
illegal whaling
activities of the Japanese just this last month. And now they're on to the Cape Breton Islands in Nova Scotia, where Canada takes this baby seal, the baby harp seal.
Oh, I can barely hear about it.
These are like cartoon characters. I mean, I wonder if everybody's familiar with this. They look like cartoon figures.
Oh, they're so sweet.
Yeah, they're the sweetest little things. And then these sealers, as they call them, the men who do the seal hunt, they come and they pick them up, and they're completely trusting, and they smash their heads in. They stomp them, and one time, Captain, the founder.
Captain Paul Watson.
Captain Paul Watson, who's a former member of the Canadian Coast Guard, he's tried to stop that since 1977, and actually they had been successful, I just saw that, for quite a few years. Oh, yeah, 1985 to 1994, is harp seal pup hunting was made illegal. This year, Canada is about to kill 325,000 baby seals.
Oh, that's just awful.
Now, let me...
I don't get it.
Well, I don't get it. So what do they use these for?
Their fur, isn't it?
I mean, there's people, like there's women going to wear the fur.
Disgusting.
This can't be.
Awful.
It can't be. But anyway...
I don't know. That's the only thing that I can think of.
Let's see here, though. The Canadian Coast Guard is harassing the crew of the Farley Mowat, which is the name of their ship, named after a Canadian conservationist, and trying to prevent documentation of the inhumane slaughter of seals. Not that you could have a humane slaughter, by the way.
Right.
Bad writing here, I would say. But it is illegal under Canadian law to film seal hunts because they know that people are just filled with revulsion.
Well, it's the most awful image. I've seen it maybe once or twice, but if there's anything even remotely about that, I can't watch it.
Yeah, one time,
too. It's a vision you never forget.
Well, there's a couple of things. Jolene and I, several times, have interviewed Captain Paul Watson, and one time he had gone to the Magdalen Islands, which are out in the Atlantic, but formerly part of Quebec. And he and others had worked up this idea where they could comb these seals, get the fur from it, and leave them alive. But it was like the sealers said, "Oh, that's for sissies.
Aww.
We want to kill. We want
kill,
blood.
Kill.
Yeah." So he was staying in this. He was staying in this hotel, and I think it was in the Magdalen Islands, the Ile de Magdalene. Yeah, the Magdalen Islands. And he was there with the president of the United States on West Wing. What's his name?
Oh, I wasn't. I never watched that show. Can you believe that?
No, but what's the guy's name?
I don't know.
Jeez, I can't. You know, he's got like all these kids that are actors too.
Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen.
Oh yeah, he was our president.
Yeah, right.
For
right.
a while there.
So he's there with Martin Sheen, and a mob of 200 sealers attacked the hotel, broke down the door in which Captain Watson was staying, and were going to do something like lynch him. And the Quebec police refused to do anything, and it was only because Sheen was there that he was able to get, like, the American consulate somewhere to intervene with the Quebec authorities, who finally told the cops to stop this assault on Captain Watson.
Now, that's courage.
Yeah. Another time, they took Captain Watson prisoner on one of these sealing ships, which is just filled with, thousands of dead baby seals.
Oh.
And one of them, it did something like, you know what, if I say this, it could be an exaggeration. So I'll just say what at least happened. So this guy took this baby seal and just crushed him right in front of Watson.
Oh.
And
so he's up the working on this again currently.
Yeah. Captain, let's see here. Yesterday, four men from the Magdalen Islands died when their 12-meter aluminum-hulled boat capsized while being towed through heavy ice by the Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker, Sir William Alexander. One of the survivors blamed the tragedy on excessive speed and lack of attention by the Canadian Coast Guard. Captain Paul Watson, himself a former member of the Canadian Coast Guard, said, "This is incredible. The government of Canada allows hundreds of small non-ice class vessels to navigate in the most hostile waters on Earth in heavy ice, and then they say they have no contingency plans to deal with rescuing these same vessels. Perhaps if they spent less time making plans to prevent the documentation of the seal slaughter and more time being concerned about protecting human lives, these men would not have died." And this is extraordinary, that in fact that is the case, that you cannot In 2005, 11 Sea Shepherd crew were arrested after being attacked and assaulted by sealers on ice. Despite being struck by sealing clubs, punched and kicked, not one sealer was arrested for assault. The attack was videotaped and the sealers identified, yet the Royal Canadian Mounted Police stated there was insufficient evidence to charge the sealers. The Sea Shepherd crew, the ones that were beat up, were jailed and fined for approaching within a half a nautical mile of a seal being killed, which is also, against Canadian law. And the Canadian government essentially subsidizes all of this.
That's so awful.
Because they don't
There's so many things I love about Canada, too.
Yeah.
But that's not one of them. And really, why do people want to wear dead animals on their...
So you wouldn't wear, like, a leather coating?
No, I don't own a leather coat.
All right. But...
Would you?
I don't know. I've never had a leather coat.
I mean, okay, so now
we're going to catch
heat because I have some sweet Coach leather boots that I love, I have to say.
But on the other hand...
The fur thing's a little,
The vegan thing, never doing any harm to animals. But then what do you wear? You wear clothing made out of synthetics.
Right.
So we're fighting war in Iraq. Well, hemp would be all right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very comfortable.
I know. But my jacket, in fact, the WRIF jacket that I'm wearing is made out of synthetics, which means it's come from oil. So we're fighting a war in Iraq for oil.
Uh-oh.
You can't win.
You really can't.
No, it's terrible.
You know, but I did the vegan thing for a while and, you know.
Really?
Yeah, and you can, you know, when you get, like, Vegetarian Times magazine, in the back, you can buy shoes that are, you know, cruelty-free. None of them were real attractive at the time, but...
I didn't bring that thing. Did I send you that about the vegan strip club?
Yes, you did, in Portland, Oregon. And it's where you can find, soy protein replaces beef in the tacos and chimichangas. The dancers wear pleather, not leather.
Yeah, it's plastic.
Many are vegans or vegetarians themselves. It's the Casa Diablo Gentlemen's Club. And it says, but Portland is also a home to a lot of young feminists, and some are not so happy with Mr. Diablo's venture. Of course, he has
to... Well, they don't like any strip clubs.
They're right, yeah. Right. But Mr. Diablo has to come in and say he isn't concerned with the feminazis.
Which is a right-wing...
I hate that term. They can call me that all they want. I really don't care, really.
All right. This is Night Call. I'm Peter Werby. Jelaine Jordan is with me. 313-298-WRIF. I haven't even looked at the email yet tonight. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. There's some open lines. Let's go back to our phones and talk to Joe. Joe, it's Peter and Jelaine. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. Where are you calling from? What township?
Disgusta Township.
Okay.
just think about that rebel flag thing we were talking about, and we'll just leave it there.
Okay.
I wanted to weigh in on two things and kind of segue through Paris. Follow me here.
Okay.
Wow.
We're talking about the ratio between Muslims and Catholics/Christians.
Let me just bring people up to speed. One of the things I brought it up is that apparently now Muslims have become the world's largest religion, beating out Catholics, although Christians still make up a third of the world, bigger than the Muslims. All right, go ahead.
I remember watching something maybe last summer, some documentary, and they were talking to some young Muslim girls, I believe in Paris, and something that really jumped out at me that they said was, you know, here the mosques are all full, but the churches are mainly empty. And that just kind of, you know, it's sort of a reminder just of the fundamental ist maybe aspect of religion, and that I can kind of, you know, in my own tangent, you know, go off into the whole thing of the age of these religions. The Christianity, it had its bloodshed years too, but we're not, the Crusades were centuries ago, whereas Islam is much younger and maybe it's going through its bloody, you know, 12 centuries or whatever. And segueing to truckers through Paris, is it not how they do it in Paris? For example, and maybe even other European cities, when these truckers strike, they don't park their trucks at home. They park them in the street,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. They take to the streets in a big way. I've seen it firsthand in Paris.
So some strategically placed semi-trucks throughout town could, I mean, we don't necessarily need Evie Brown or whoever else you know, for these owner operators to really come. We need the truckers. I can hear it in you guys' voices. I can feel it. I can hear it in other callers last week. We need the truckers on our side in this.
Well, one thing I didn't understand during the 1995 to 2000 Detroit newspaper strike, which involved the majority of unions involved were Teamster unions. Why in the world they just didn't bring about 300 rigs to downtown Detroit and park in front of the news and the Free Press buildings and saying, yeah, settle the strike and we'll go home. All right, Joe. Well, take right. Yeah, what?
I said that's absolutely right. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, sure thing. Thank you for calling 313-298-WRIF. All I see on the board here, it says theory. Slayer, is this, in fact, Maurice with the theory that will blow my mind? Yes or no? Right? Uh-oh. Okay. All right. Let me... Hi, Maurice. But right now, you are not on the air, which I'm going to put you up in a minute. But if this theory, you've got... You're on thin ice.
Yeah.
If this doesn't blow my mind, you're out of here quick. So what's the theory?
Quicker than usual.
Yeah. What's the...
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Maurice.
How are you doing, Peter?
Yeah.
You know what? It's been saying since about a couple hundred years ago, six families started this country.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that before?
Yeah, one of them's mine.
Okay, what I'm saying is take the six of the countries to Europe. Can you?
Well, I think, here, this is...
You have the dollar bill. I'm sad to say I don't.
Yeah, but you're going to go bye-bye if you swear anymore, so don't do that.
Dollar bill over the pyramid.
Yeah.
That's a Masonic plan.
Yeah.
Okay. Now.
Okay, I'm looking at it.
Somebody get in trouble, like, go to the church.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't laugh at me.
I'm sorry.
We're not. Just keep it clean.
I'll keep it clean. Pete, listen to me.
Or you're going to be back in trouble with me, Maurice.
I used to live out by the Metropolitan Airport right back in 57. I used to see police cars, Detroit police cars, go through Inkster, all the suburbs, out to Metropolitan Airport and back. Nothing on the news. These cars were riding low. Okay?
Wow.
I was thinking this.
Yeah, tell me quick.
What better security force to have to transport dope than the police? What better distribution area to have with the church?
Well, I think the six families you're talking about are, I think those were the mafia families that controlled New York. all right, I got to go, Maurice. Thank you. 313-298-WRIF. Where in the world is Adam Brooke? I mean, he was so stoked when I emailed
him
earlier.
Talking about the hash bash. We'll get him.
But here, we'll do a little musical interlude for the hash bash.
Lovely.
Yeah, this is a song we play every year, although I think I missed last year. And
it's scheduled for this Saturday.
That's right.
Right?
First Saturday in April every year on the Diag at the University of Michigan. Do not bring anything illegal there.
They have these dogs.
Well, you've been there. I've been there, too. I never saw the dog.
Yeah, they bring them out.
Yeah, because for one thing, it's like a misdemeanor to be caught on the streets of Ann Arbor with possession of marijuana. Mm-hmm. It is a felony to be on state property, which is the University of Michigan.
Ooh.
So you get in a world of trouble.
Yeah.
All right. So here, Burning Incense is the band. The CD is Get Me High, and this is Hash Bash, a night call on WRIF.
Well, I told all of my friends we should be leaving town. And there really is better things to do than to be hanging around. We've got a date in a town named Michigan, and we're sending a protest wish again to all of those who still have ears, let them hear. Cause we're going to the hash, and I'm for hash bash. We're gonna see some folks, and man, we'll have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. And we'll see you there. Don't be late. I ain't talking about crack, and it ain't about smack.
stuff like that. The soft drugs aren't the same, so let's call them by their name. We gotta make some changes, so let's start with hemp. Those are going to the hash, and over hash bash. We gotta see some folks out there and have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. I'll see you on the diag at U of M. Going to the hash, and over hash bash. Saturday in April, when all those who aren't hypocrites get a lungful. And if you all can't be there, then be on your own town square in a spirit of civil disobedience and fire it up. Because we all do the hash, and over hash bash. Well, I see some folks and man gonna have some fun. Do more harm than the ones we're breaking. I'll see you on a dime. Don't be late. Going to the hash, and over hash bears. We're gonna see high times, man. We're gonna see old Chef Fryer. Now the laws that they're making are worse than the ones we're breaking. And at this point, we'll be lucky to escape martial law. Go to the hash, and over hash bash. All us season folks now, man, we're going to have some fun.
101 WRIF, you're listening to the Night Call Show, a little musical interlude there from Burning Incense, Hash Bash, and we actually have our guest to tell us why, in fact, that the Hash Bash this year may be canceled after 37 years. We'll talk to Adam Brook, who has emceed the event for several years now, right after these, so stay tuned.
This is WRIF.com.
It's Rock and Racing Day with a Riff. Join 101 WRIF Live on location this Saturday starting at 8 p.m. at New York, New York in Chesterfield as we gear up for the Gaines Go Indy 300 from Homestead, Miami with free live performances from Tantric. Plus, that same night, Cinder Road. With special guest Detroit's own Matt Austin. It'll be one hell of a party as we get ready for WRIF's first race broadcast of 2008. Join us for the party this Saturday night at New York, New York, inside the Premier Entertainment Complex on 23 Mile, just 2 miles east of I-94 in Chesterfield with your rock and racing station.
101
WRIF.
The Riff. Under my skin,
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And Jalene Jordan is dialing Adam Brook right now to talk about the hash bash. These guys that do this hash bash stuff, this is challenging. This is extremely challenging. But anyways, we'll have him on the air in just a second. Let me get the news item here. Hash bash takes place at the University of Michigan. We got him?
He's on.
No, he's on. All right. That takes place for the last 36 years. I said 37. It's been held on an area called the Diag, big square, except it's on the diagonal. And suddenly something has happened. But let's welcome, and we've talked to him any number of times before on the Night Call show. Here's Adam Brook. Adam Brook, thanks for joining me and Jalene on Night Call.
Oh, hey, let's click it on.
Oh, thank you. Did you do it?
No.
Go ahead. One of us got to do it. I don't have that.
And after you just get done saying this is about other people, yeah. See what happens?
Yeah.
Karma is.
Yeah, like, wow, man.
Karma.
All these lights are flashing. What's not happening? All right, here we go. Adam Brock, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey.
Hey, what's happening, man?
How you doing?
It took a lot for the three of us to get here.
That's right.
Yeah, well.
But here we are.
So what's up with the hash bash? Some other group reserved the diag?
Well, something real interesting has happened. The university had a policy of only allowing us to reserve the diag on the first day of the current semester. And that's been the case for years since they've required us to have a permit. And
right.
The student group that U of M Normal was the student group. They got together. They went to apply for the permit after stopping into the office and checking that the dates were available previous. They go to turn in their permit, and they're told someone has already reserved the diag. And because graduation is when it is, the only dates that were available in April, which would have been April 5th and 6th, are now reserved. And they're not available. And something new, they won't tell us who reserved them.
Because so you
the past,
yeah.
Yeah, that was my biggest question.
Before. So you don't know. You haven't been able to find out who it is, huh?
Actually, we have.
Can you tell us?
No.
All right.
I can let folks know that Hash Bash is happening.
Yeah.
That we are negotiating with this group to basically explain to them that while 4,000 or 5,000, 10,000, who knows what the weather's going to be like, but thousands of people are going to show up for Hash Bash, it would behoove them to give us the hour that we need for our amplified sound. The problem is, unless the university gives us a permit, we will have to utilize their permit and their amplified sound. So
these
it
people,
does get a little technical.
So it was actually, this wasn't a group set up by the University of Michigan to try to stop the hash bash.
No, in all fairness, this group last April 5th, they announced that April 15th, 2008, they were going to hold an event on the Diag.
Wow, wait a minute. That's when hash bash is April 15th?
No.
Okay.
No. Hold on.
Right.
They announced that
April
15th they were having an event on the Diag. Come to find out that the universities told them that the Diag won't be available on April 15th, and it was only available on April 5th. However, they let them reserve this in the fall, which is something that they've never let us do.
Mm.
So we're kind of crying foul with the university, but what are we going to do, drag them into court?
No, you have in the do you have psychedelic music on, man?
No, there's a television in the background.
Oh, okay.
I'm off.
Setting the mood, man.
And our pal John Sinclair is going to be there, right?
Yeah, he's flying in from Amsterdam tomorrow, actually.
The big chief. Yeah, I just got an email from him. I did indeed.
So,
well, you say the Hash Bash is the largest, least advertised, most attended event in America.
Yeah, that's to my knowledge, there are more people in Ann Arbor on Hash Bash Saturday than any other day. The restaurants are all full. The bars are all full. Every restaurant is full. It's an all-day thing. The Chamber of Commerce in Ann Arbor loves the Hash Bash. However, they refuse to come out in support of it. But they will tell you that it's a very busy day in town. You know, all the parking garages are full. You know, the streets, you can't move in town if the weather's good. It's, you know, bumper-to-bumper cars, and you can't move.
Hey, it's good for the economy.
It's great.
Michigan's challenged economy, as we call it. Yeah.
We basically bring thousands and thousands of dollars to Ann Arbor, and it's a guaranteed boom for the city, so they love us. And that's why we don't have any hassles in the city of Ann Arbor. We don't give the city any troubles, and they allow the Monroe Street Fair to happen after the Diag rally, so we have a place to party, and, you know, it's a good time.
But people,
by all.
People should be careful, particularly on the University of Michigan campus, that they should not do or bring anything illegal.
Oh, yes, definitely. I like to warn people that the university police officers do enforce state law, and, you know, if they do catch you smoking on the Diag, they will arrest you. Now, in the past, we've done some things like had everybody sit down during the Hash Bash, which then left the police standing there, you know, holding cross with their arms crossed, not able to walk through the crowd. And we noticed that when the crowd's sitting down, people can smoke because the cops can't walk up to them. So we've done things like that in the past. But I wouldn't smoke on the Diag.
Yeah.
That's not true. If someone hands me a joint, I'll take it.
Well, and you stand out, Adam.
And I'm the MC, so, you know,
yeah,
they're not going to arrest me.
There's not a website for this. You can go to johnsinclairradio.com, but...
Yeah, you can... there's a MySpace page, Michigan Hash Bash, MySpace/Michigan Hash Bash.
Okay.
Our HashBash.com page is being reworked, and actually we weren't expecting such media exposure. We ran got an AP story run right recently, and hit a couple of the news stations in town today. So
that's great. All right, it's
doing well.
It's next Saturday, right?
Next Saturday at high noon on the Diag, and as you said, John Sinclair will be there. And then after the rally on the Diag, we're going to head over to the Monroe Street Fair and party the afternoon away there.
Adam Brooke, thanks for joining us on Night Call.
Appreciate it, Peter.
All right. Thanks a lot. I do appreciate you coming on the show.
I feel sorry for the group who's reserved the Diag.
Yeah, maybe it's... I wonder, I can't imagine.
I don't really feel sorry for them because they're taking that date away from Hash Bash.
Are you going to go?
Maybe.
I've been up there at a number of them.
I might go.
In fact, I went up there one year with Drew and Mike and Trudy. We had. You ever see that? We had a big shirt.
Oh yeah.
I still
used to go. Do a lot
except
of stuff
on there. Saturday, I'm going to an all-day Tai Chi workshop.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Wow! I can't wait to see you on Sunday.
I'll be so mellow.
I know.
Actually, the guy giving the workshop is an 80, is he 80? Yeah, 81 now. Ben Lowe, B-E-N-L-O. He says, you remember me. I make you Ben Lowe.
Yeah.
And, in fact, if anybody cares, any martial artists out there, you can just Google Ben Lowe. He's quite an amazing human being. In fact, he had a liver transplant.
And, did he really?
Yeah. And he's still doing it. So I'm committed to that, or I would be up there just to show support. So I was saying at the beginning of the program that some people will say, talking about the Hash Bash, why aren't you talking, this is supposed to be a political talk show.
Hillary.
Yeah, why aren't you talking about Bush? Man, this guy commits a crime a day. I don't want to go into that.
At least one.
Yeah, at least one. But this is important because, for one thing, millions of people have become enmeshed in the judicial system, in the prison system, because of these outrageous laws about people that want to change their consciousness. This is adults. Now, there's a lot of things we keep away from children, which is very important. But this, again, is parental concerns, public health concerns. In fact, any negative aspect of any intoxicant, just like alcohol, is a concern of a public health concern.
Right.
And people should know fully, in my estimation, that the duty of government is to let people know what possible harm can come of certain activity.
Sure, right? Sure.
And there should be a prohibition. Like, they shouldn't allow, I don't know what, I mean, certain things. But it's not up to the government to decide whether or not I can smoke flowers or whether you want to do something even more powerful. You want to take poppy and make it into heroin and put it in your veins. Very, very stupid thing to do. Everyone agrees with that. So if everybody agrees with how stupid it is to do that, why does there also have to be a law against people doing it or, in fact, possessing it? It's no part, well, it's actually part of the prison industrial complex, all these drug laws. Billions of our dollars have been spent. I mean, it's like a mini war in Iraq. I mean, not that much that it's gone down the rat hole of Iraq, but billions and billions and billions. Or maybe it has after all these years. I've seen figures on this, but it's astounding. And when you think about us intervening in Colombia, where we've already given them about $2 billion to stop coca production, growing and producing it into cocaine. And of course, none of it ever changes.
I was going to say, as if.
Yeah.
There's a documentary that's on cable right now called Locked Up, and it's a lot about the prisons, and it's just it's appalling. These guys are in there for, you know, having some weed or coke, and in there for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, that friend of mine who got sentenced to 22 years in federal prison, and it just occurred to me, he just wrote me. He said, "Hey, I'm getting out early. I'm only going to have done 20 years."
And do you remember how much he had?
Oh, quite a bit.
Okay.
quite a bit. But well, it wasn't like he was hanging around.
Little Scarface going on.
Yeah, well, no, he was at a some middle level, he was supplying cocaine to adults, a lot of professionals, a lot of people in fact, in the criminal justice system as well. And
how surprising.
Yeah. I knew someone I know, a relative of theirs, who was a prosecutor, and he would prosecute cocaine cases. Actually, it was in Miami. And this guy went to court stoned on coke all the time.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, it's
I know quite a few criminal defense attorneys who are...
Well, they're known for it.
Pretty much.
I've never known a...
Way into it, yeah.
Like it. Yeah. All right. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, we're taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is the Night Call Show, and let's take some more calls. Here's Chris. Chris is in Warren. Chris, thanks for joining us on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks again, Peter and Jalene. How are you guys tonight?
We're good.
Hey, great. How are you?
Hey, good luck on the Ben Lowe course tomorrow on your Tai Chi.
Yeah.
On Saturday.
Yeah.
Hey, it's not only the regular people that are on coke and stuff, it's a lot of the politicians, too.
Do you think? Do you really think that?
Hey, at least the new governor of New York admitted it.
You got it. He's going to admit it right before they can pull the dirt on him. It's the best thing to do.
Isn't that the greatest?
And Obama. Didn't Obama admit to doing coke? I think so.
Or to doing some drugs, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think he said coke, yeah.
I like talking to you guys all the time, but I just want to do a plug-in. I had the chance to meet one of our fellow congressmen. Actually, he's one of our current congressmen, Joel Nolenberg.
We don't like him. Oh.
I'm not going to mention the location, but I wanted to plug his website and possibly his phone number.
Wait, why?
Basically wants to know, and if you give me a few minutes, I could share this with you. It says, how can I help you? In big lettering. It says, my offices are here to assist you in your dealings with the federal government, which is clearly what we like talking about the most.
Yeah.
I hope you will call on me and my staff whenever you need information or assistance concerning the federal government or to share your views on important issues and legislation being discussed in Congress. So if you give me a few seconds, I'd like to provide this for you if you don't already know.
Yeah, tell me quickly, though. Go ahead.
Okay. It's www.nolenberg, that's KNOLLENBERG.house.gov.
Yeah. And actually, Gary Peters is running against him. Nancy Skinner, who actually called here a few weeks ago, she dropped out. I was sort of surprised.
Is she really?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't tell you. Yeah.
No.
First I wrote her. I said, why am I the last to know? She dropped out of the race.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
His phone number at his office also is in Farmington Hills. You can call direct. It's 248 851-1366.
Man. So we're going to call him and tell him how he can help us out. Drop out of the race.
Yeah, he is. He's like a Bush clone.
He's awful.
Absolutely awful. Nancy almost beat him with $400,000 in 2006. He had $3 million. And this year, I think that properly the Democrats are going to be giving full funding to Gary Peters, who's going to be running against him. And, Joe, you got to go. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for having joined us. Let's see here, and I'll keep reminding people some of these calls are about, is the Vatican announced that it is now number two. It's no longer the largest religion in the world. The Islamic religion is now number one. So here's Mike in Windsor. Mike, it's Peter and Jillian. Thanks for making our show international.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good.
I just wanted to call and talk about the recent Muslim, well, not necessarily Muslims, but there's wants to be a change with the national anthem in Canada because of the reference to God.
Yeah.
And I just think it's completely absurd. It's like going against all the true Canadians' rights to change their national anthem
It says God in your national anthem?
Well, like...
sing it for us. Not,
yeah.
Sing it. Wait, we can sing ours. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light. Okay, so we can do it.
That
you
was
can
a
do
little
it.
Pitchy.
Well, yeah, I can sing it, but I don't want to waste you guys.
Go ahead.
We love it.
Where does it say God, though?
Oh, Canada, our home and native land, true patriot love, our... Oh, I can't even remember right now.
Yeah.
And God, la la la.
Yeah. It doesn't really like necessarily specify on which God. It just says it just has God in.
Well, they got one of those. They have one of those. What's the beef?
Well, like they're talking about changing it because they feel like there's a reference to God in it. And they don't believe in God.
No, they believe in God.
Well, they believe in a God, but not. The God that, like, Christians and...
Don't they
Catholics
believe in the same... Don't they all believe in the same God? I mean, they think Jesus was a prophet and all that. They don't think he was a savior, but...
I'm so tired of all this stuff. What can I say? You know?
Yeah,
jeez.
Yeah.
Get a life, people.
Not you. We're not talking about you, Mike.
Right, not you, Mike. Yeah, no, not
but,
at all.
All right.
We like you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Eh?
Yeah. How about that? Is other Canadians says God in your national anthem? I never... in old Canada? I don't know.
I don't know the song. I've heard it many times.
Sure.
At Red Wings games.
Yeah, I was going to say... Toronto Maple Leafs.
Right. I've heard Karen Newman sing it.
She sings O Canada?
Yeah, I think sometimes when there's a Canadian team, she does both.
Oh, that's nice.
I'm pretty sure.
All right, some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Inkster, and it's not Al. It's Jimbo the cabbie. Jimbo, hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jillian.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Excellent.
Good. Well, actually, you guys were talking about Hash Bash a little while ago, and I just wanted to say that being a former agricultural child of the 80s and back in 1983, my family's pot farm in Tennessee was the number one bust in the state at the time. I believe that corporate America... meaning the big oil companies, et cetera, they don't want this. They don't want a natural drug like marijuana legalized because they know that once it's legalized, it can change the world. Now, Henry Ford, back in 1936, developed an engine that could run off of hemp oil.
Yeah, a lot of the hemp stuff. And I think didn't he have a car that was – actually, the car was made out of hemp, wasn't it?
Yeah, but more than that, the combustible engine could run off of the hemp oil. And this is an acre of marijuana in a growing season produces as much oxygen as 20 acres of trees in the same amount of time.
No.
Now, this is something that could absolutely save our environment if it was commercially grown. And it's just ridiculous. You know, it's like our leaders don't use common sense.
Well,
and I think that's what's got so many voters in this country frustrated right now, the fact that we vote for these people and nobody has any common sense.
Well, I know that's not in quality in high. Can't even finish my sentence.
I can't help you on this one.
All right.
Usually I
can. Thank you, Jimbo. Thank you.
But
let's
we agree,
see
it
yeah.
makes no sense.
They ain't got a lot of, whatever. Here's Coz in Canton. Is that it, Coz?
Coz.
Hey, Coz. You're on the air with Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you guys going tonight?
We're going good.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on a couple things about the hash bash. You know, I hope a lot of people come down there and sign that petition they have every year, you know, and get it on the ballot. I mean, like he said, it could help the world in a lot of ways, not just the fuel. I mean, look at all these people that have illnesses, and it helps them, you know.
Sure.
Like there was that man on Montel Williams a couple years back. Heck, that guy had to smoke just to feel normal.
And yeah. Well, as we were saying earlier, we had interviewed a woman who ran a marijuana hospice, and this relieved the nausea from chemotherapy.
Yeah, it issued AIDS patients.
Yeah, and all that. And the Bush government raided this place, took these dying patients and made them into criminals. But it ought to my way of thinking, it really ought to be a civil liberties issue. That the government doesn't have any right to tell adults what they can and cannot do in terms of what we ingest into our body, how we want to discover. I don't even want to make it into a great philosophical thing about. We always going to say we could, you know, inner philosophical investigation. How about people just want to kick back,
chill out,
listen, enhance music, enhance sex. What the hell business is it of the government? And why should it be something that clogs the judicial and the criminal system? But it's a racket. It's like so many things in this society. It's a damn racket. So it's the prison industrial complex. The drug laws create clients for the prison industrial system. And, of course, our tax dollars, which in many states is more spent on prison than on education, it goes there. I mean, screwed up priorities. Absolutely. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see, where are the Canadians, eh? Come on, is there God in O Canada or is there not? I don't know.
We could go to the Google.
Yeah, okay, here, this is good. We need this call, and I can't see the name on it, but you're calling from Dearborn, and you're a Muslim. What is your name?
Mohammed.
Oh, yeah, you've called before, Mohammed. Hi.
Oh, yeah, I've called plenty of times. I'm a big fan of you guys, especially you, Peter, and you, Julian, because you're the backbone.
I'm the backbone now.
Yeah, right, behind every great man is a great woman.
Hey, that's all right.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did want to clear up. My friend from Canada just called in and said, no, we don't believe in the same God. Yes, we do believe in the same God as the Christians and the Jews believe in the same God.
Yeah, clear this up for these people.
Yeah, I knew that.
And we believe that Jesus Christ was the prophet and not the Son of God. But there was a saying that, like, there's only a slight difference between us and the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They're basically the same religion, but, you know, I don't know. Misinformed about it. You know?
Well, it's not so unusual to not think that Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, Jews don't think that Jesus is the Son of God either.
Right, and they're not demonized for it nearly as much as.
And also, like, you know, what some people say when they hear the word anti-Semitism, it also, like, when somebody, like, has, you know, hatred towards Arabs and Muslims, that's also anti-Semitism as well, too, because we're both Semites, descendants of Abraham, so I don't know.
Well, Mohammed, I appreciate the information.
Yeah, for sure.
And thank you, guys.
All right, thank you.
All
right, thank you very much for, you know, I should have made that point because I knew them. And then I all of a sudden.
No, you did make the point.
Well, I started to fuzz out a little on him. All right. Okay. I was going to say to Al Slayer, who's doing our phone screening and who we thank so much for that, that I couldn't read all the names on here. Like, I couldn't read Muhammad's name. It was just like symbols, and it was. But now all the names are showing. There's a number of people starting to call about marijuana. And stay on the line if you're there. But, you know, let's not just get into, hey, man, let's legalize it, okay? I think probably 90% of the RIF audience agrees that
you
at least
appreciate a good Bob Marley tune.
Yeah, but we agree that that marijuana should not be the source of what sends people to prison.
Right.
If I'm always curious though to get anybody on that thinks that there's a good reason why that marijuana shouldn't be legalized. But oftentimes over the years I've done this, someone will say, "Well, I started smoking marijuana, then I started doing heroin."
Oh, the gateway drug theory.
Yeah. So
right.
Wait a minute. You smoked marijuana, and then you went on to heroin, and you had a problem with it, and that means you think I should be a criminal because I smoke marijuana, which I don't.
And didn't. Yeah, right, exactly.
I only do the drug of despair, alcohol.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, right. You're a lightweight, too. You don't need much.
Listen. What do I always say?
You're a cheap date. That's what I say.
I experimented with marijuana in college, and the experiment was a success.
It was a success. Yay! Yeah.
Okay, here's Joe in Canton, even though he's not in Canada, says he knows the words to "Oh Canada." You going to sing it, Joe, or?
I don't think you want me to sing the whole song. It's three quarters into the song.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it goes, unless you want me to sing the song.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll say, "Oh Canada, our home and native land." Oh wait, "Oh Canada."
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Okay, wait, I'm Simon Cowell. You're out. It's American Idol.
Three quarters into it.
Yeah.
It goes, "God keep our land glorious and free. Oh Canada, we stand on guard for thee."
You stand on guard?
Oh, what?
Twice.
That you, God appeared a second time in O Canada?
Yeah.
Huh.
Wow.
I go to plenty of OHL hockey games with the Whalers.
Yeah, sure.
So I know the song. Everybody's singing the American anthem, but I'm always singing the Canadian anthem.
Yeah. Well, what does that make them? That makes them almost like a religious country. Like the United States is a secular country. They don't have anything like that.
Supposedly.
In the Star Spangled Banner or in the Constitution. You know, God is not mentioned in the Constitution ever.
Right.
Yeah.
Just the Pledge of Allegiance.
Well, it's good to talk to you both. Of you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. Thanks for that rendition. It's always.
Thanks for being gutsy enough to sing on the airwaves.
Yeah. But remember, folks, and some of you have been listening a long time, have heard this before, that the Pledge of Allegiance didn't have the phrase "under God" inserted into it till the 1950s because these right-wing Republicans.
The Knights of Columbus. The Knights of, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they had some congressman who was afraid we might be confused with godless communists if we didn't have that in that. Actually, think about this, too. The Pledge of Allegiance was devised in the 1890s by a socialist minister, by a Christian socialist named Bellamy. And he could have put "under God" in there. He didn't want that in there. He had the opportunity.
Wait a minute.
Here's Eric from Chatham, and he says, "There's no God in O Canada." What's up here?
There's no God. We stand on guard for thee, but there's no God in there. Even if there was.
That guy thought it was God the whole time.
No. It's on guard. It's on guard, you know.
Wait. I was thinking, stand on God. I was like, what is that? Okay,
we're already changing our stuff over here for everybody else coming over here. Whatever happens to the old saying, "When in Rome, do like the Romans."
Oh, jeez.
I mean, they're coming over here to make a better life for them, that we're better over here. Why do they want to change our system into their system?
Who's they?
It doesn't make any sense.
Wait. So this is, you're saying that actually there was some Muslims that said they wanted to what?
Well, no. You get them, like when I was growing up in school, they were just first starting to come over, and they were like the Jehovah's Witnesses. They'd go stand outside for the Lord's Prayer and for the National Anthem, which was like, okay, the Lord's Prayer,
my butt would have been outside too.
I mean, the fact that they went and stood out for the National Anthem, it's like, well, wait a minute, what country are you in now? You're in our country. Why are you standing outside when the National Anthem's playing? That's not right. I mean, if you come to a country, you want to become a citizen there, you got to
play the game.
Well, I guess so, but I'll tell you one thing, Eric, is that it's always happened with your ancestors from Europe and my ancestors from Europe and Jolene's that the older people particularly aren't real quick to adopt the ways. The kids are quicker, and the parents, they're saying, they have to marry in, and they have to learn the language, and they have to keep the same religion. And, you know, another generation down the line, there, you know, the people are indistinguishable from everybody else.
Yeah, but I went through that as a kid. Like, my parents came here in the 50s. I know the language. I know the culture. I went through school here for that and everything. But, I mean, we never forced it on anybody else.
No, they're not forced.
Like the Canadian game at the same time. But we just enriched, like here, we're another culture, Yucky, you can see it, but we're not telling you, you've got to do it our way now.
Well, wait a minute, they're not saying we are either here in the States or in Canada, that any of us have to do it. They don't have the power to do it. They might request it, they could even demand it, which I doubt if they are, but they don't have any capacity to do that, and it's like I say, I mean, like for instance, pardon me, in the Dearborn area, which is a real, you know, it has the largest concentration of people from the Middle East anywhere in the world outside of the Middle East. And you already begin to see this mix. You see women in very traditional dresses and head covered and all that. And then you start to see the younger people and some of the older people. And as people are here, I mean, like, for instance, when there's tremendously large communities, and it can be more insular, like the Chinese community in Toronto, for instance, a lot of that is maintained, or in New York, where they, you know,
LA.
Or LA.
Wow.
Yeah, they have Japantown and all that, Koreatown, and that tends to be insular longer, and the loyalties tend to be more towards the ethnic group there. But the more people are allowed in, for instance, and you do better if you're allowed in. I mean, people know that. Wait a minute. If I learn English and I dress like everybody else and I speak my language at home and I have my religion that just happens on Friday or Saturday or Sunday, whenever people happen to do it, it works better. So it all worked out. Don't worry. We're okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks for making our show international. Let's see here. Here is Joe. Joe's in Detroit. Joe, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Jolene.
Hi.
Hello.
I just wanted to tell you about a visit I had to the Henry Ford.
Okay.
They have a little library there that few people have probably ever visited. And my friend Paul, I'm not going to mention his last name, his grandfather was a chemist for Henry Ford. So we went there looking for all this information about the hemp car you were talking about a little earlier. They brought out about 6 boxes of information, little clips of, you know, this and that. There was like samples of upholstery and I don't know, headliners, all kind of different car parts you wouldn't think of that they had tested. And there was a lot of interesting information in these boxes, but we really had to search for it. We did find only one mention of the hemp car, and that was the cover of a Forbes magazine from the 1940s.
Really?
So you can find that black and white cover, Forbes magazine, Henry Ford introducing his hemp car. I think the hemp made some sort of plastic.
We had a car we used to call the hemp car.
Yeah. We all had one of those. We all had one of those, Pete. Another interesting thing that we found was a 3-page typed letter or story. And I can't remember this guy's name, but you remember when you're in elementary school back in the 50s and 60s and you had those mimeographs that with the blue ink?
Sure. Hectograph.
They smelled good.
They smelled
good. Hectograph. I've never heard that word.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, this was printed just that way with that bluish ink.
Wow.
And 3 pages. And this guy told a story. Henry Ford hired him first to do depth reading 7 miles out along the Great Lakes. And the story goes on, when he got close to Detroit, he asked to use the Ford yacht to do this depth reading. And Harry Bennett did all the work for him, and he was very surprised because he thought he was saving money by not renting a boat to do this depth reading. But instead, what Harry Bennett did was he had a full seven-course meal for him and everybody that was on the yacht that day.
And then he went back and beat up some UAW strikers. All right, listen, I got to take a break.
The story gets a lot more interesting, Pete. Let me finish.
Well,
please let me finish.
Cliff Notes.
30 seconds. Cliff Notes. Headlines. Go ahead.
Okay,
I got to take a break.
Henry Ford, his next job for the guy was for him to start, he wanted him to get rights from the U.S. government to start planting hemp seeds in Dearborn.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of trouble doing it. Henry Ford finally told him, says, go see Harry Bennett. Harry Bennett makes one phone call, and the next day they have approval to plant hemp seeds in Dearborn.
Wow.
Now, the guy goes on, and he says a year later after, I should say this, too.
Wait, no. Listen.
The main problem is that we're up against a commercial break.
We got to do it. So we're going to have to, what people should do, and I think what you began with, Joe, was really important. Get out to the Henry Ford, the old Henry, what they call the Henry Ford Museum.
It's extraordinarily
interesting. So thank you. Sorry to cut you off, but we got to go. When we come back, we're going to talk with Bob, who's in Sarnia, who says, there is God in O Canada, the national anthem of that. So
why can't we get this right?
313-298-WRIF. Is there God in the Star Spangled Banner? Everybody knows no. How come you guys south of us? Well, Sarnia's north, but in Windsor, you're south of us.
But we do know they're not standing on God.
Yeah,
right. They're standing on guard.
This is WRIF.com. VIP access to concerts and events, an on-air gig with the world-famous 101 WRIF, and a $40,000 salary. The next casting call for the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search is happening this Saturday, starting at 3 p.m. at Macomb Mall on Gratiot and Roseville. Bring your photo, bio, and resume, and show us if you've got what it takes to earn 40 grand in the sweetest gig you'll ever have. The 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search. From Bud Light, keeps it coming at 101 WRIF. Everything rocks.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Whoops, our turn to get back on. Hi, Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan here with you. Till 1 a.m., you have overwhelmed us with this email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com with whether or not there is God in the Canadian National Anthem. I'm going to get Bob from Sarnia on in a second. Although Gary in Windsor writes, the guy that claims he knows the Canadian National Anthem has spent too much time at the Hash Bash. The line is, we stand on guard for thee, not on
stand
God.
Stand on God.
You know, there's that,
oh, that
there's,
was one fine moment there.
There's all those books that have rock lyrics that people misunderstand. Have you ever seen those?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to think of them. Oh, yeah. And there, I remember actually, speaking, this fits in, the Blue Oyster Cult song, Don't Fear the Reaper.
Yeah.
And some guy, I remember, called and says, hey, man, can you play Don't Fear the Reaper? You know?
He is paranoid.
Gary says, it is the secular humanist and atheist that would like to remove God from the anthem, not the Muslims. Well, you're right there. Whoa, no, don't do that. Don't do that. All right, here's one more. No, this is from Al from Inkster. He says, Jalene, do you have a date for the Hash Bash?
Oh, Al, you're so frisky.
All right, let's see. Let's go to Bob in Sarnia. Hey, Bob, you're on the air. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I think we know the answer, though. God exists in the national anthem.
Yeah, it's God keep our land glorious and free.
Yeah.
And then it's, oh, Canada, we stand on guard for thee. So it's definitely in the national anthem.
Well, someone called in to say that, in fact, it is in the U.S. national anthem, just in the fourth stanza.
Verse.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the U.S. one, but it's definitely in the Canadian one.
By the end of the show, we're going to know this song.
Yeah.
All right. I was
singing it.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate appreciate that. Wasn't I saying just the other week about this friend of mine who wrote a poem which essentially is the Star Spangled Banner backwards, Banner Spangled Star?
I don't recall
and
this.
The last line is, see, you can say O.
Oh, yes.
I like that. Ken Mikulowski, if you're listening. Hi. Let's see. Here is Mark from Monroe, again, from the home of Fermi II and General George Custer. Mark, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Good morning, Pete and Jolene.
I can't believe that Monroe actually has a statue of General George Custer in downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that guy like the Big Loser?
Well, larger than life. Oh, they love him. They love him here.
Really?
Yes, indeed. Not some of us, but... They're working on the War of 1812 battlefield now. That's the next big thing. All the industries left, the Ford factory's closing down, and this is going to be like a military town of Michigan here. But I was calling to just state that God is really in trouble. You know, all the gods, and Catholicism is especially in trouble because they've got double jeopardy. You got Islam growing and Catholicism is shrinking.
Right.
And I just went out to the American Atheist Convention last weekend, and, you know, the speaker was just fantastic. But there was one book, The Myth of Nazareth, this archaeologist digging around, along with a bunch of other archaeologists. They reached a conclusion that this little village of Nazareth didn't even exist when this guy Jesus was supposedly walking around.
Wow.
And so all the while, Christianity is kind of shrinking here and growing in the third world that's kind of backwards in science. The advances in science here are just jerking the rug out from under all the fairy tales. The farther down archaeology digs, the farther back in time, the people realize that humanity existed before these Jewish folk tales. And... it's just amazing that when people find religion, they get saved and they think they've got it all figured out, and they discontinue reading. The majority of them discontinue reading anything other than religious literature. And so they've got it all figured out, and they don't look at, you know, at other issues, and they are really stumbling into an abyss, actually, because the world is changing around them at a rapid pace, and they aren't even paying attention.
Well, you know, Mark, there was a study done recently, a 34-nation study found Americans less likely to believe in evolution than citizens of any countries polled except Turkey.
There you go. Absolutely. Wow.
And this is in a column by Nicholas Kristof in Sunday's New York Times. Says President Bush is also the only Western leader who doesn't believe in evolution, saying the jury is still out.
I don't know. Please. It's scary.
It is. Oh, it's beyond scary, isn't it?
Absolutely. I went down when the Creationism Museum was opened down in Kentucky for the grand opening.
Yeah.
And I didn't go in. I'm not about to give them any of my money, but it's just amazing that these knuckleheads are teaching children that the universe is 6,000 years old. You know, dinosaurs roamed around when humans were roaming around. There were dinosaurs on the ark and all kinds of insanity. And I don't know. They should wake up because they're in big trouble down the road. And, you know, of course, the Christians are very vocal now. They know that they're in decline, in my opinion, and they're very vocal. You got, obviously, people at the federal level in the government. They're trying to revive it. And
infiltrate.
Yeah.
You know what else I've noticed is this movement toward these giant, these mega churches.
Yeah.
And, in fact, someone in my family, back in my my home state, my sister, she doesn't listen to the show, so I'm just going to just throw this out there. But she goes to this gigantic church where they have full-time chefs.
Oh, yeah. They have coffee shops.
They play rock and roll.
Yeah.
And this is what they have to do. There's going to be Starbucks in these churches pretty soon.
There are. No, there are.
Are you serious?
There are. Or there's, I don't know if it's Starbucks. In fact, I think there may be Starbucks.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. I throw my hands in the air. I give up.
Yeah, I hear you. This is the one that Ted Haggard, I think, was the big kahuna of. They've got two Starbucks in that one church. And these knuckleheads, the Christians, you know, all these churches, they'll give you guilt, fear, and sorrow, and then they'll sell you the salvation. Just bring your money, throw it in a basket. You know, they call it seed money. You give a little cash, and God will look favorably on you, and oh, boy, everybody will be happy. But it's amazing, these mega churches. It actually says in the Bible somewhere, God tells the Jews, don't be... You know, if you build an altar to me, don't take a tool to it. If you do, you'll pollute it. And all these Christians don't, you know, according to that, all the Christians don't realize that the bigger their church is, the farther they are away from their God. And here you got old George Bush, who said that God told him to bomb Iran, and it's just insanity.
You know, it's just like those candles that you can buy for, like, money or things like that.
Yeah.
It's, to me, I just kind of feel the same about that.
All right, Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter, and Jolene, have a good night.
Yeah.
You too.
All right, and I don't know why talking to Mark reminded me. I should give another reminder of this. I'm going to be speaking at a presentation of a film. It's called The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, that I took a Cuba trip in February of this year, and they're going to show this film, which shows how this sort of decentralized environmental movement has taken root in Cuba. I'm going to give a few of my observations. It's going to be this Thursday, April 3rd, at the Northwestern Unitarian Universalist Church in Southfield. It's on Northwestern Highway, just on the service drive, just south of 10 Mile Road.
Do you know how many people think you're going to be struck down when you walk in those doors after tonight?
This is a Unitarian church.
I'm just kidding.
There's no crosses. They don't do any God.
Just
thing.
Question marks.
But, just a bunch of question marks everywhere. That's what I, you know, actually, I am not really an atheist. I'm an agnostic. I don't even care at some level. I don't even care about the question.
I don't care much about the question.
I mean, it's
either.
The religionists. Well, the religionists I know are good, decent human beings in the peace and social justice movement, or just living their lives, and they don't bother other people. But religion has had such a horrid history, of all of them, all the huge organized patriarchal sky god religions have really done awful things. And I got to say, the people that I know and the people that are probably listening now, and I always, like I say, I always feel badly about talking, you know, trash about something that's very important to them. But I think it's good, if you will, and why I am not respectful, in fact, irreverent, is that I think if it wasn't taken for granted as a cultural icon, religion, that more and more people would say, you know, this is a bunch of hooey, and I'm not going to have anything to do with it. If you think it works in your life, and if you think God is real, and Jesus is real, and all that, fine. But
I think it's the fear of burning in hell that people just can't get out of their heads.
Yeah, well, there is a deep tradition of spiritual connection in the species itself.
Mm-hmm.
But what really went wrong, I think, is when we stopped having these nature-based religions and started, like I say, have these sky gods that had to be beseeched, and that were patriarchal, and that, most important, that affirmed a hierarchical society. So that
right.
they, because they always, every major religion, I know some of them were rebellious, and I know that there are a lot of historical incidents where Christians and Muslims and Jews and all that have led revolts against authority, but in the main, they've had the function of sanctifying class and political relationships. In other words, hanging with the rich rulers.
Right. Yeah.
And that's how it started. That's how it all started. Never mind. This takes me too far. Let me just say that at 1 a.m. Eastern time, if you're elsewhere in the world, you can do the math. Jeff Thale is going to join us. Actually, I think the first one is going to be Larry Edelman. He's the executive producer of this incredible PBS four-hour special on stress and health called Unnatural Causes, Is Inequality Making Us Sick? And you can see it here in the Detroit area. And they're saying that why poor people are as sick as they are is partly they don't get the best medical care, but also the overwhelming stress that all Americans live under, that's accentuated among the poor, is really the cause of this epidemic of that bad health.
I will buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Jeff Thale, the director of the Washington Office on Latin America, who we talked in general about stuff happening south of our border, and I thought it was a real good interview. So that's, well, you know how to get my attention. Here's somebody somewhere. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete, what's going on, guys?
We're just doing it, man. What's up?
How you doing, somebody?
Turn your radio off, somebody.
It's my minute phone, and I'm running out of minutes, Pete.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that something needs to be done.
You got it.
I think it, like in the mortal words of Jim Morrison, I'm the lizard king. I control everything except change lizard to insects and add some clothes. And
he was on peyote, dude, during that scene.
Put him in
balloons
and drop him on Baseline Road in a windy day going up towards Oakland County, because I couldn't even get any gas. And when I got to Wayne County, I was lucky to be alive last night under 75 and 4th Street. Thank you and have a good night.
All right, man.
Right on. Okay. Keep on keeping on.
What do you think his... we have this screen here that tells us what the callers are going to talk about. What do you think it said under here?
It said nothing.
No, it said left-wing progressive political movements.
For that guy?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe he got stage fright.
Some people have been here a long time. Let's get Jason in Ypsilanti. Jason, hi.
Love
you're
the
on
doors.
The air. Ooh,
love
we got to get
doors.
People on quickly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Yeah, I was calling to comment on, you were talking about the drug trade earlier, and I guess I just wanted to make people aware that it's not really a new thing in America to have a large drug trade that basically, a lot of people think the CIA is involved, like Air America, that's been proved and things like that, but it goes back way before that. And, in fact, I've done some research in this area.
Wait, let me just tell people. That's not the liberal network, but rather the CIA Air Force. Yeah.
Right, yeah. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, that is a secret air operation that brought drugs into the United States during Vietnam.
Right. You got to give us really the shorthand on all this because we're running out of time.
I'll be real quick. Many of the original wealthy families of America made their original fortunes off of trading opium in China, between China and India. The British were also getting rich off this, and a lot of these wealthy families are connected to wealthy British families, even after the revolution. One example of this family is like the Forbes family from Forbes magazine.
Yeah.
John Murray Forbes there was a other family called the Perkins family he worked for. He grew wealthy in the early 19th century. He built the
headlines. Come on.
Okay. Another one was Dr. Benjamin Rush, who signed the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
He advocated heroin in medicine back then.
Well, that, they used that into the 19th century. There was something in people may just vaguely remember from 19th century British history when they were colonizing Asia. They had what they called the Opium Wars, and the Chinese rulers wanted to stop the British importation of opium. They were bringing opium from India, and they brought the wrath of their military down on China for refusing to allow the importation of opium. A lot more to the story, but we got to get out of here.
So long history. Long history.
Yeah, so do we got time? Let me see. How many commercials? All right. Let's see. Here is Samantha from Redford. Go ahead, Samantha, quickly, though.
All right. Hey, I just wanted to say that as much as everyone wants marijuana to be legalized, it's never going to happen because the government is getting way too much money out of it.
There you go. All right. Let's leave that as a contention and see. Where's my time? Where's my time? What time is it? How come I can't? Oh, here it is. Wow. let's see. Here's Bill. Bill from Toledo. Go ahead, Bill, quickly, though.
Good morning, Peter, Jolene. Got a short one. I'll take about a minute and a half. Do I have time?
Go ahead, quickly.
Okay, 10 big bank CEOs. 10 big bank CEOs went out to dine. One got his credit card cut in half, and then there were nine. Nine big bank CEOs with the regulators till late. Next morning, one was sent to jail. Then there was eight. Eight big bank CEOs taking their bad mortgages as high as heaven. One decided to try to stay there, and then there were seven. Seven big bank CEOs seeing their dividends go to nicks. One stole himself, begun, and then there were six.
All right, we're going to have to do the other five next week. Call us back, Bill, for real, for real.
We just crunch.
We have to get out of here, yeah. So, yeah, a couple of things that I wanted to remind you about. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, you'll see all this information on the trucker strike that's going to happen. Pardon me. This week.
Tuesday,
April 1st. Yeah, they're calling for a nationwide strike against fuel costs. And so you can go to the Striking Trucker website there as well. Let me see what else. Oh, yeah, my photos of my Cuba trip are there. Plus the interview, and wasn't my interview. It was the interview that Jalene Jordan did with me about my trip there. And let's see.
We could have talked for a couple more hours, I think, when we did that interview.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
And go to the Detroit calendar on the left side of the site, and you can find all the information about the Sierra Club documentary on Cuba that I'm going to be hosting this coming Thursday, April 3rd. So all that.
Wow.
Yeah. Should we go out with a rousing...
see you at Hash Bash.
Yeah. A rousing chorus of O Canada. I'll do O Canada. You do the Star Spangled Banner.
Stand on God.
O Canada. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We'll be back next week. But stay tuned for the interview.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
Hey, it's Joe Mike. Have a great weekend, and Monday morning we'll talk with Ernie Howell about Tiger opening day baseball. Also, Monday we'll talk with Doug Rice, who's amassed a book of bathroom stall graffiti. Oh, my God. You would not believe some of this stuff. And we'll see if we can track down that 80-year-old woman who did battle with a mountain lion and live to tell about it. Plus, we've got Piston playoff tickets to give away as well, all right? See you Monday morning with us, Joe Mike, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Yeah. All right, I'll see you guys there.
Drew and Mike, weekday mornings on the Rare. No subscription necessary. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Yeah.
is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
This is Peter Werby, and thank you so much for joining us. All of us are concerned about our health. In fact, many of us are very, very concerned about our well-being. This is a country that is the wealthiest country in the world, and we spend the most amount of money on health care. Yet, as we know, there are almost 50 million people without health care. But even those of us that have it seem to be focused a considerable amount on health or really ill health, and how endemic ill health seems to be in a society that has those very positive qualities to it. I was thinking about that, and I've thought about it a lot in myself and my family, and all of a sudden I find out that people that are thinking about it in grander ways and able to present something of extreme importance are ready to roll out a PBS series called Unnatural Causes. Is inequality making us sick? This is going to air on PBS Sundays through April 20th here in the Detroit area. And if you're listening elsewhere in the country, it's going to be airing through on Thursdays through April 17th. Well, we're fortunate to have with us on the Peter Werby Show, Larry Edelman. Larry Edelman is the series creator and executive producer of Unnatural Causes. He's the president and co-director of California Newsreel. That's the country's oldest nonprofit, award-winning, socially engaged film and video, and they do a lot for universities, libraries, and public broadcasting. Been doing it for 40 years, and he oversees Newsreel's production, has helped develop dozens of Newsreel releases. He joins us from San Francisco. Larry Edelman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. A pleasure to be here.
Well, I, in some ways, I sort of summed up the question, didn't I? Because we think that the reason that we're so have so many problems with health is primarily it's those 50 million, a little less, that don't have health insurance. But that's sort of what they say, the tip of the iceberg.
Well, we all saw Sicko, or I hope we did. It's a great film. Sicko is about our repair shops. In a certain sense, it's where we take our bodies when they break down. But we like to think of Unnatural Causes, we get a little presumptuous, as the prequel to Sicko, because it's about what's making us sick in the first place. And why are patterns of health and disease so differentially distributed? Why are they so different by depending upon your class status and your race?
Well, I always thought that it made sense, and there was just this study came out that said the gap in life expectancy has widened for the nation, and just as the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, it seems like the rich are living longer and the poor are living less. The poor don't eat well, and they don't have health insurance, and they're in dangerous jobs, and they tend to smoke more and use drugs. So end of story. Let's get those poor people getting some better life habits.
Yeah, well, that's the standard conventional medical discourse, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, first of all, it's not surprising that the poor are sick. If you see anyone who's homeless, look at that person. They're going to be sick. Two things, though. There's also a gradient, what they call a gradient to disease. It's not just a sort of this bifurcation, a on-off. To be rich, you're tend to be healthy. Poor tend to be sick. But all the way up and down the class pyramid, there is a gradient, so that if you're in the middle, the fact of the matter is the middle class people live on average more than 2 years less than those who are rich. Poor folks live on average almost 6 years less than those who are rich. So at every step on that ladder, there is this gradient, this wealth-health gradient. And needless to say, it's not surprising that since 1980, that as inequality, as economic inequality has grown in this country to so now that is greater than at any time since the 1920s, that the mortality gap, the difference in life expectancy between not just the rich and the poor, but the rich and the rest of us is wider than it's ever been. Now you put your finger on, so where do we go with this? We say, oh, people just should take a little more responsibility and shouldn't eat that second piece of pie. Stay away from McDonald's, get your, exercise, eat right, maybe do some meditation. All good. But why is it, Peter, you think that we just always end up on this sort of personal response to these larger social conditions within which we live?
Well, that's the, I guess it's not the $64,000 question anymore. It's probably the $64 billion question these days, right?
Yeah, I mean, you turn on the news every night, there's probably a health segment on what you can do to be healthier. But why don't they talk about living wage jobs?
Now, it's everything is thrown back onto the individual. It's individual responsibility. We're a very individualistic nation, we're told. And if you're sick, it's because you're eating white rice instead of brown rice. You're, as you said, too much fast food and you're smoking. What do you expect?
Yeah, it's your fault.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that people shouldn't take responsibility for doing what they can, obviously, to eat right and to make healthy decisions. But there's a lot of things that affect our health that have absolutely nothing to do with decisions. The most obvious example, I suppose, would be if you live near a toxic dump.
Mm-hmm.
That's the decision you made. What happens if your plant shuts down, moves to a maquiladora? That's not a decision you've made. Why is it that you have, wages and benefits that are dictated not by you because, you know, you don't have a trade union or a trade union has been eviscerated, so you don't have any bargaining power? Or that's not a decision you've made. So we have the situation here where we tend to ignore the fact that there are many exposures to health threats, as well as things that can be done to promote our health, such as, and it's simple as whether or not there is green space in your neighborhood, whether or not there are supermarkets, farmers markets, or you got to take two buses to get to one. These are things that are products of that we as a society have made, which have to do with our social policies. In this country, Jared Bernstein, the economist Jared Bernstein, has a great line, I think. He divides the world into two types of countries, yo-yos and wits.
Oh.
If you've had him on your program, cut me off.
No, go ahead. I have, but go ahead.
Yo-yos are, you're on your own societies. Wits, we're in this together societies. And an example of this is in our series, which we, part of it, one of the shows, was shot in Western Michigan in Greenville. And Greenville happened to be the home of the largest refrigerator factory in North America called Electrolux. 3,000 people lived there. 2 years ago, they shut down. They moved to a maquiladora in Juarez because they can pay folks a couple of bucks an hour rather than what the $15 an hour that they were paying in Greenville plus benefits, though they did pay the folks bus fare in Juarez. And it devastated the town. It turned it upside down. You see, as the layoffs took place, increases in within a year, emergency room, the visits to the emergency room tripled. And it wasn't just domestic violence. It wasn't just alcohol abuse. There was plenty of that as people trying to cope with the situation. But it was hypertension, heart disease, and that's, you know, these are the things. These chronic diseases is what's killing us in America in middle age more than anything else.
Well, Larry Edelman, let me just cut you off here because there's an S word that we haven't mentioned yet that's pretty key to unnatural causes is inequality making us sick, and you may have just about been ready to get to that because that's what happened in Greenville, Michigan, with the closing of the Electrolux plant, because here were people what were fairly decently waged. I believe they were union, and yet suddenly their health stats go down the drain.
Yeah, maybe we should bleep that word out too. Huh? Chronic stress.
Yeah,
exactly. Chronic stress. We all know about stress, right? We're all under it. All of us face it. In fact, it's something that evolution put in us so that we could cope with immediate threats. That tiger jumps out from behind a rock way back then, and your body goes on alert, right? Your blood sugar goes up, your heart starts to beat, blood pressure rises so you can fight or flight, like we were taught in high school. The threat disappears, and the body goes back to normal. What we find, however, is that as your continually faced with uncertainty, as you're continually faced with the bills that you're piling up, schools that aren't working, worrying about your job, even if you're not laid off, worrying about your job. Well, let's say you're one of the 47% of Americans who don't have paid sick leave, 47% of those who work in the private sector, and you're sick and you have to choose whether or not, gee, do I go to work today or do I stay home and miss a day's pay, let alone if your kid's sick. Those things basically trigger that stress response, not like that saber-toothed tiger, but at a low level.
Well, Larry Edelman, is that fact or your opinion? I mean, in other words, you're saying that stress is is an indicator that we're going to start having these poor health statistics. Is this like a hypothesis, or are we going to be presented in unnatural causes the PBS series that you're the co-producer of. Is this shared by, like, the medical profession?
Well, we don't believe in magic. There's got to be some way that the outside gets into the body, gets into the inside, and affects our physiology. And what's interesting is that increasingly, researchers are pointing to the way in which this chronic stress response is one of the ways in which our body is placed at risk for the chronic diseases. And one of the neat things about the show is we show some of that science. We depict that science. We see what happens when, in fact, that you're put in positions that are subordinate, where you don't have power, and the risk that raises that, how arteriosclerosis, for example, arteriosclerotic plaque in your blood vessels rises, how blood pressure rises. CEOs, you know, we have this myth that CEOs, high-pressure CEOs, are dropping dead of heart attacks. It ain't true. It's their subordinates. And the fact, because there's a difference between pressure and stress. And this is, I think, a distinction I like to make because we sort of miss it. We're all under pressure. But to the extent that pressure triggers that stress response, by which I mean to say, in essence, the cortisol and epinephrine and the other hormones which trigger this rise in heartbeat and blood sugar, which puts you at risk for diabetes and all these other chronic diseases, which scientists call, by the way, allostatic load, that depends upon whether we have access to the resources to manage the stressors which impact our lives, manage the pressures which are about to throw our lives out of course. So a CEO is under a lot of pressure, but the CEO's got advisors, consultants. The CEO gives orders, doesn't take orders. The CEO has, goes out to lunch with important people and is made to feel important to him or herself, maybe has a car pick him or herself up in the morning, and when all is said and done, can go off to vacation to Aruba, if not to call in out-call massage. The rest of us don't quite have those access to power, access to those resources. So the fact, what's interesting is that a CEO's blood pressure will go up during the day, but at night that blood pressure goes back down to normal. The lower you are on the economic ladder, on the socioeconomic ladder, the less likely it is that your blood pressure at night will go down as much as that CEO. Now, we're talking averages here. We're not talking everybody. Let's be clear about that. We all know poor people who dropped, you know, lived to 106, and CEOs who dropped dead at 49. But on average, the wealthier and more powerful you are, the longer you'll live and the healthier your life will be.
Now, Unnatural Causes, the PBS special with the subtitle of Is Equality Making Us Sick? Is going to air here in Detroit on WTVS Channel 56 Sundays at 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock around the rest of the country at 10 to 11 Eastern Time through April 17th. Did I say in Detroit? It's through April 20th. So this Sunday you can listen to it, well, both here and around the country. I was fortunate enough to get a preview of the whole show, but a 30-minute preview DVD that was available to the media. And, just that at one point almost brought me to tears when that woman just began to tear up herself, saying, we don't have enough money to pay our bills. It was very dramatic. And the other one has to do with race. And Larry Adelman, you produced a documentary, Race, the Power of an Illusion. So I know this is one of your concerns and one that California Newsreel produces documentaries about. And I think it's worth telling the story of the woman who you would think would not be at risk from health problems, but yet her premature baby is what wound up experiencing it.
Well, you know, it's we look at, on the one hand, that the health and well-being follows a socioeconomic gradient, a pyramid, if you will, as we were saying. And it's not just the poor who are sick, but the middle classes, those of us, you and me, Peter, I suppose, if I may be so presumptuous.
I hope so.
Our health is also, on average, not as healthy as those who are above us, but healthier than those who are below. However, at every step on that pyramid, it turns out that African Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, some other groups, often fare worse, even at each step on the ladder. So say, how does that work? How is it that, in other words, racism can also get into the body? And one of the ways in which we take a look at this in the show, which is a fascinating story, is about preterm babies and infant mortality. The infant mortality rate among African Americans is well more than 2.5 that of the average, 2.5 times that of the average American. And that's a figure, by the way, which has not come down. It's as high as it was in 1950. In fact, even an African American woman who is a college graduate or a professional has as great a risk of delivering a preterm or low birth weight baby and having her baby die before it's one as a white woman who hasn't finished high school.
Hmm.
What's going on here? Well, obviously, you know, in this particular situation, because you can't blame lack of prenatal care because she was a lawyer, well-educated. In fact, she had worked for many years as chief counsel for a hospital, so she got plenty of prenatal care, exercised, ate right, lived well, didn't have any of those problems. However, the baby was still born young, 2.5 pounds. Now, in her case, who knows? There are many factors that affect any particular event or outcome, but on average, we see this. And what's interesting is, however, what we see is the added, increasingly, scientists are circling in on what they call the life course hypothesis. That is, the cumulative burden of racial insults, of having to live with racism throughout your life, and how that takes a toll on the body, increasing those stress levels, which tend to perhaps trigger premature delivery.
Hmm.
So you have this situation where racism is an even added stressor. We all face stress. White folks face stress. People of color, though, often face a higher level of stress, both because of their economic circumstances and, in fact, through direct interpersonal encounters with racism that puts the body on alert all the time. So, I mean, look, if I could, Peter, if you went, Peter, are you white?
Yes.
So am I. So if we go into a restaurant and we don't get served, what's your reaction to the waiter?
I don't mean the service is slow.
Yeah.
Mild irritation.
Yeah. And what do you think of what's the reason?
They're rushed. They're not a good wait staff. Something that. Usually I try to just sit calmly and think this gives me added time to talk to whoever I'm eating dinner with.
Yeah. Or you might even say the waiter's an idiot.
Yeah.
Or incompetent.
Right.
I don't know an African American friend of mine that I've ever eaten with. When this hasn't happened, particularly male, has part of him has said, is it me? Part of him has said, is there racism going on, assuming that the wait staff is white, in which most cases around here in the Bay Area it is. And that puts the body on alert. That's what we're talking about. Just that going on alert stimulates those hormones, those stress hormones, is in one of the ways in which they accumulate through the life course, which basically we now find puts that body at risk for all the chronic diseases. So what we're finding, by the way, one of the reasons why African Americans, for example, live on average shorter lives than others is not what you read in the paper. It's not crime, as bad as that is, and drugs or even HIV/AIDS. The biggest killers are heart disease, stroke, hypertension, diabetes, which are killing people before their time in their middle ages, when they're 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Well, doesn't that thesis, which was presented even in the preview DVD that I said by researchers, again, this is not just the opinion listeners of the filmmakers. This is all tell. Or how do we say it? Show, not tell. That's right.
We're telling now, right?
Yes. In Unnatural Causes, the PBS special that's going to be airing Sundays, Latino immigrants, recent ones, they seem to have great health and no problems.
Isn't that interesting?
What's up with that?
Indeed. This is what's called, some scientists call the Latino paradox. It consists actually two parts of that. So we have, lots of Latino immigrants who come here, and they are poorer than the average American. So you would expect, given what we said before about this socioeconomic pyramid or ladder, because they're lower, their health would be worse. The fact of the matter is new Latino immigrants have on average better health than the average American. But there's a second part to that. The longer they're here, the worse their health becomes.
Boy.
So after five Latinos who are here for 5 years or longer are now something like 150% more likely to be obese, to have diabetes, and to run into additional health problems. And this is compounded in the second generation. So this, what is it about? What's going on here? It's what is it that's taking such a toll on their health? Now, one of the reasons, by the way, that they're healthier is because of, let's be clear, the health, the so-called healthy immigrant effect. If you're sick, you're not as likely to sort of make that, you know, immigrant, migrate and take those risks of moving to another country.
Sure.
And there's also hopefulness. The reason you move to another country is you're hoping your life is going to be better. But as you basically yourself join that rat race, and after years after years after years from working hard, striving, trying to get ahead like the rest of us, and run up against those dead ends all the time, that hope is also eroded.
Mm-hmm. Also, there's a strong ethnic identity and family identity and connection to historical traditions, I would suspect, are important.
The scientists tend to think, and again, the evidence, is these are hypotheses, none of this has really been proven, but tend to think that obviously building social connections, having strong social networks, being connected, helps for everybody. That social isolation, we know, can kill. So there's a question of inclusion, being included in society, and this is terribly important. This is one of the ways in which segregation works. The more in ways in which, you know, segregation is a form of social inclusion, not allowing folks, people of color, to participate fully in the institutions of America. And that takes a toll on folks' lives.
Larry Edelman, we only have a few minutes left, and you actually said you might give me a little health quiz, and I told you I was probably going to get 100%. Do you want to launch a few at me and see if you can take my arrogance down a step?
All right. We'll see what we can do. We'll throw you a softball first,
okay.
All right. So how does America compare life expectancy compared to other countries? Or we'll give you three choices, okay?
Okay.
Are we in the top five? Are we in the top 12, or are we in 29th place?
29th, definitely.
I gave it away by not giving you a whole number.
Yeah. Well, no, I actually know that. In fact, I was going to say, in terms of stats, the infant mortality rate, which is very low in the United, or very high in the United States, were what, like same thing, up around in the upper 20s.
Actually, we're even worse.
Yeah.
According to the CIA fact book, and I'll defer to the CIA despite their problems with finding weapons in Iraq. We're 30th in infant mortality.
Okay. In Detroit, and it's around 6 point something. In Detroit, the infant mortality rate is 17 per 100,000.
Wow.
That puts us down like in 80 something. Well, we should do this quickly. Give me a couple more.
Okay. Where does the U.S. rank in the percentage of the population that smokes cigarettes? Are we in the top 5, the top 20?
Top 20.
Actually, we're below 25th.
Oh, okay.
So Japanese who live 4 years longer smoke twice as much as we do.
Oh, okay. So I'm not doing well. 50-50. Let's go.
All right. What's the greatest difference in life expectancy observed between counties, different counties in the United States? Is it 5 years, 15 years, 22 years?
Five.
Mm-hmm.
Five.
22 years.
Oh,
there are some counties in the United States where people are living 22 years longer than others. That's the difference that's greater than the difference in life expectancy between the United States as a whole and Bangladesh.
This is amazing. Well, we're almost out of time, so we probably should get towards wrapping this up. And although we have a little bit, because this is not just an oh my God, although it has had that effect on me as well. But this is, and for someone to watch and think, oh gee, maybe I ought to eat, not have the second piece of pie, as you said earlier. But people are starting to move around these issues. People are starting to take these issues on in a social and political manner the way they have to change all of our lives.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't leave us on a note of despair here. I was getting off there in that direction, too, because the show is also about possibility. You know, during the 20th century, American life expectancy increased by 30 years. We lived on average about the age of 48 at the turn of the century. Most of that increase, by the way, did not come because of new drugs and medical advances. Most of that increase came because we did things to share the prosperity of America's growing industry with all of us. The 8-hour workday, the banning of child labor, Social Security, civil rights. These are all things that have basically helped Americans live longer by living better. And in the civil, during the civil rights period, this, with the civil rights legislation, the war on poverty, Medicare, the actual gap in life expectancy between black and white and between the poor and the rich actually narrowed. Between 1966 and 1980, the mortality gap narrowed. Nancy Krieger has just done a very important research paper on this.
We have about 30 seconds. I know that's a lot to put in.
My point being, and then in 1980, we started going in the opposite direction, the wrong way. So we have made these changes before. We can make them again. European countries certainly have. Why can't we? It's a question of political will.
I think you're absolutely right. And to begin with, we have to have information. This is an extraordinary series. Just seeing the previews made me want to see the entire four segments. It's going to be on WTVS, Channel 56, this Sunday through Sundays, April 20th in the Detroit area. And nationally, it'll be Thursdays through April 17th, 10 to 11 p.m. You should check your local listings. Well, this is an incredible series, something we all have to know. You thank you so much for both for joining me, but also for putting this all together. It's called Unnatural Causes. Is Inequality Making Us Sick? You can go to unnaturalcauses.com.
.org,
folks. Unnaturalcauses.org. Also, my website, peterwerby.com, will have a link as well. We've been speaking with the show's creator and executive producer, Larry Edelman. Thank you so much for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you.
WRIN.com. Every 88 minutes, all this weekend, the Riff could be your ticket to jet off to Sin City. Keep it locked on 101 WRIF all weekend long, because every 88 minutes, we're blowing out passes to the special WRIF screening of 88 Minutes. Starring Al Pacino in theaters April 18th, one lucky Riff winner will win a trip to Las Vegas for the premiere of 88 Minutes at the Planet Hollywood Casino. The Riff's 88 Minutes to Vegas weekend. Listen and win on 101 WRIF.
Memories are just weighing down, dragging waters till the depths give up their dead. What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, don't fall away, being mad to myself, don't fall away, and leave life leave. We'll be right back.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. It's a pleasure to have you with me. And our minds have been taken up so much these last couple of weeks with Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's situation, his indictment and what have you. Certainly the economy wearing on all of our brains. And we've entered the sixth year of George Bush's war against Iraq and the occupation there. So a lot of other things seem to get moved to the margins, things that that are important. And they're important because they're important, period. But they're also important because they have a direct impact on those of us here in the Detroit area and southeastern Michigan. One of them is U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. Joining me is Jeff Thale. Jeff Thale is program director for the Washington Office on Latin America. As program director, he consults with his staff about WALAD's programs, and that goes from the Southern Cone to Mexico. In addition, he directly oversees the Cuban Central America teams at WALAD and includes the Central America Youth Gangs Program from his Washington office. It's a pleasure. We were trying to figure this out. I think welcoming back Jeff Thale. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show in any regard.
Thanks. Peter's great to be here again.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, this is not the main focus that we were going to talk about, but it really struck me what you do with the Central America Youth Gangs Program. I don't think that's a big issue here in the Detroit area, but in some of the cities, or is it?
I don't think it is. It is in New York. It is here in Washington. It's a huge problem in Los Angeles. Places where Central American immigrants have moved in, it's a big issue. Because there are these, youth gangs in Central America itself are a huge problem. They're really the problem they are today because we deported so many young people back to Central America in the mid-1990s. And shockingly, the two biggest gangs in Central America are both named for street corners in Los Angeles.
Boy.
So it's a big problem there. It's a big problem here. There are connections between people there and people here. The big issue, though, is that, you know, and this is true with all kind of youth issues, there's a real temptation for the cops to come in and say, boy, you've been causing trouble in this neighborhood. Let's lock up everybody we can and throw away the key. And you see in Central America, just like you see in the United States, in the long run, that kind of strategy doesn't work.
Why wouldn't it work? You would think that getting the bad guys, as they come to have been called, off the streets would do it. Of course, you swell the prison industrial complex.
Two things happen. One is you wind up arresting not just the hardcore criminals, but a much broader swath of young people, some of whom have made mistakes, but who are not serious criminals. You wind up putting these people in jail. You wind up letting them spend time together where they get more organized, and then they come back out on the street and your problem's worse. And you'd do a lot better if you had a smarter police strategy on the one side, and then you put more money into youth programs on the other.
Well, okay, I can hear a few minds clicking out there. Coddling criminals, soft on criminals.
Having been mugged a couple of times in Central America, I can tell you I'm not soft on criminals at all. But I think there's a difference between guys who are, organizing and planning high-level robberies or murders and, kids who are hanging around in the equivalent of the schoolyard and drinking and getting involved in low-level crime. And to treat them all as the same thing is a really big mistake.
Now, is this an argument that is used against immigration? And if so, is it a real one?
It gets used a lot. I mean, people who talk about, immigrants come in and they bring crime with them here. And the funny thing is it's actually the opposite. It's, in fact, that we deported so many of these people and the crime in Central America has gotten, and these gangs in Central America have gotten worse. Like I said, in fact, most of these particular gangs started in the U.S. and then moved to Central America rather than the other way around.
It's interesting. There's a famous book, I think it's from the 1920s, which I actually have at my house. I found an old edition somewhere or other, used bookstore, called The Gang. It is a sociological study of gangs. And, of course, they're talking about Irish gangs, Italian gangs, right. Jewish gangs, people that we no longer associate with organized criminal behavior in any broad scale, and certainly not with youth gangs. I mean,
right.
And so now the phenomena, the modern phenomena, seems to be African American gangs and gangs from Latin America.
Right.
So what we're always talking about is first recent immigrants, and secondly poor recent immigrants.
Yeah, I think that's the really striking thing. And, you know, if you look back at that book in the 20s, you're exactly right. It's Irish gangs, it's Jewish gangs, it's Italian gangs, and all of those groups eventually integrated into the mainstream of American society, and the problem has gone away. And, you know, and so you see the same phenomenon today. Some people would argue that for African-American gangs, if you look what's really a phenomenon of migration from rural areas to the cities, in the 50s and 60s, in the next generation, you see youth gangs. And then, you know, Mexican-Americans and Central American immigrant groups, too. What? And so in some ways, the challenge over time is to deal with this crime problem on the one side, but also with figuring out how you integrate people into American society on the other.
I know that there's a famous quote by the police chief of New York City in the 1890s where so many of the people arrested for crime were Eastern European Jewish immigrants. And, in fact, in the newspapers, they would identify, you know, Moshe Cohen, Russian Jew, was arrested for blah, 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 blah. And the police chief said these people are genetically predisposed towards crime.
Right, right.
So, but in the meantime, we're dealing with people. We can have that kind of distance view, and we can suggest this and that program. In the meantime, these guys are causing a lot of problems both here and in Central America.
Right. But I guess the example, yeah, it's a real problem, a real issue. You've got to deal with it. But I'll give you the one concrete example. Here in D.C., we had an incident in which there was a fight between two gangs, and it led to a gunfight 2 miles from the White House, and a bus driver was wounded. It was a huge deal. The police, rather than going out and arresting every teenager in baggy pants they could find, convened a series of meetings with community groups and the schools and the churches, and they started a program that 3 years later there hasn't been a single Latino gang-related killing in the city of Washington. So, I think there are things you can do, and there are things people have done that actually do work, and that involve, you know, going after the serious criminals, but also involve figuring out what you do with kids in school and with their families and with their churches and so on, that help keep them out of or get them out of gang violence.
Jeff Thale is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's program director for the Washington Office on Latin America. Their website is WOLA, WOLA.org. I'll also have a link on my website as well. And tell me just a little about the Washington Office on Latin America. What's its origins and what's its purposes?
We're almost 35 years old. We're a non-governmental organization, so all our money is from individuals, churches, foundations. We look at human rights in Latin America, and we look at the connection between human rights and what the U.S. government does. So we look at what governments the U.S. supports in Latin America and how, whether we criticize governments for their human rights record or not, that kind of thing. We really started in the mid-1970s. A lot of U.S. church workers had been in Chile, and when Chile had a coup and overthrew Salvador, the military overthrew Salvador Allende, a lot of the U.S. church workers there, some of them were in prison, many of them fled the country for their own safety, and they came back here and they formed WOLA to say, we shouldn't be uncritically supporting that government.
Back in the 70s, of course, let me get rid of that pronoun. The United States government supported almost all the governments of Latin America, with the exception of Cuba, and they were these fascist states, torture countries.
Yeah. Thousands of people disappeared.
Cocaine colonels, all of that. But now, beginning with 1998, Venezuela, Chile, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Nicaragua have all have elected either left or populist leaders. So,
right. I mean, that's the interesting thing you see in Latin America is that, you know, we have been, the U.S. government has been urging sort of free markets, free trade, and free elections as the solution to Latin America's problems. And starting in the last 5 or 10 years, there's a whole series of governments that have said, wait a minute, maybe free trade and free markets unmitigated free trade and free markets aren't the solution. And you see a whole series of changes in Latin America about that. And that, I think that's a really interesting and potentially very exciting phenomenon.
Well, a lot of these, I'm looking at this list, I guess really the only country in which the United States says is directly our enemy is Venezuela, and to some extent Bolivia. But the rest of these, they sort of have mixed.
It's the interesting thing, you know, we, for the first part of the Bush administration, they looked at a lot of these governments and they said, once we get done with Iraq, we'll take care of this. And I think they've backed off for a whole variety of reasons. And we actually have, I think we've sort of, our government has said, you know, these people may disagree with us, but we can live with them. And I think, given the way we've traditionally treated Latin America, that's a really positive step.
Well, in Venezuela, which provides us with how much, what percentage of our oil is it?
It's 7 or 8% of all the oil in the United States.
And they're one of the larger suppliers.
Right.
The first, second, not first, but the...
I think they're either second or third largest single supplier.
I think it could be Saudi Arabia and Canada.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. A number of the oil companies that were doing business there, both United States companies and European companies, have said, a lot of talk, but we're doing business.
It's one of the interesting things. There was a time when they wouldn't have done that, and I think they've looked around and they said, gee, we'd like it if we got 100% of the profits, but if Venezuela wants to keep 50%, we're still getting 50% of the highest oil prices in the world. Let's go for it. And so you see big oil companies, sitting down and negotiating with the Chavez government in Venezuela and learning to live with it.
On March 1st, Colombia invaded Ecuador and attacked a rebel camp and killed a number of people. And Hugo Chavez's response was to send all these troops to the Colombian border.
Right.
And so this could. There was some talk that, in fact, this in part accomplished a rise in oil prices. And whatever it cost him, to send the troops there, he made back.
He might have gotten. Well, it's an interesting incident. I mean, Colombia crossed the border into Ecuador. Ecuador and Venezuela both have, you know, share borders with Colombia, and both saw this border crossing incident as a big threat to their national sovereignty, and both governments actually sent troops to the border. Finally, Colombia apologized in an international Latin American forum last week, and everybody has sort of calmed down. And
everybody hugged, in fact, didn't they?
Well, I forget who one of the presidents stood up and said, what we need is for all of you to just calm down and hug each other, and they did. For a macho set of characters, quite a step. The other interesting thing about it, though, is that Venezuela sent troops to the border. I mean, the whole thing was very tense for a little while. And the Colombian government recovered a computer with documents on it when they went into this rebel camp. And they allege that the documents prove that the Venezuelans were supporting the Colombian rebels, and it was a big sort of international incident. The Bush administration, which has been very strongly supportive of Colombia, took this incident as an opportunity to call for the U.S., for the Congress, to approve a free trade agreement with Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And people are pretty surprised because this free trade agreement with Colombia has been stalled because Colombia's labor rights record is one of the worst in the world. And Democrats have been saying, on the one side, obviously, they're concerned about jobs in Detroit, jobs all over the country, leaving the United States with these kind of free trade agreements. And they're also concerned on the other side that we shouldn't be making free trade deals with governments that have terrible records on human rights and labor rights. And so that's been what the debate is about. And now all of a sudden the president has come in and said, this is a matter of our national security and we have to pass this agreement right away.
Well, what is the status of some of these free trade agreements? I know, I believe it was in 2003, because I think myself and my producer and some other people, we went down to Miami to protest the free trade agreement of the Americas. And whatever happened to that? I don't think it happened, did it?
It didn't. No, you know, there was the momentum.
If it wasn't for me and my producer?
There you go.
Yeah.
Actually, I think somebody from our office was probably at the same protest.
Well, we'll share.
Fond memories.
Yeah.
There's this whole camp, you know, NAFTA got passed, which was free trade with Mexico and Canada 10 years ago. And one got approved with Central America 2 years ago. And there's a Peru agreement that's been passed. The administration really wanted, a free trade bloc throughout the whole hemisphere, and that idea is pretty much dead. I think a lot of other governments, Brazil especially, but a lot of other governments said, this isn't really in our interest. And then a lot of people in the United States, particularly in the labor movement, asked the question, is this really in our interest either? And people looked at NAFTA and said, has it really benefited people here? And has it really benefited people in Mexico? And the answer, the evaluation on NAFTA for a lot of people is negative. The U.S. has lost industrial jobs. The jobs that have developed in Mexico have been significantly lower wage than the ones here in the United States. And it's not clear that in terms of working people, and working people's wages, that it's been a good deal for either country.
Well, also, and I don't think this is hard for the, what's that guy on CNN that's so anti-
Lou Dobbs.
I don't even have cable, so I don't know. I miss all this stuff. But that people like him fail to recognize that the penetration of United States-grown corn into Mexico has ruined this whole class of corn farmers in Mexico, who the majority of them go in, rise the population levels of cities like Mexico City by the millions, or the hundreds of thousands at least. Mm-hmm. But the most ambitious ones, since they're ruined financially in their local district, they come to the United States illegally.
That's exactly right. And if you ask on this side, it's not family farmers who are benefiting from exporting all this corn abroad. I mean, it's really big agro-industrial corporations on this side. And then on that side, you ruin small family farmers there. People move into the cities because they don't have alternatives. Or, you're right, they come here. And if you look at the rise of Mexican immigration to the United States, it's clearly linked to the weaknesses of the Mexican economy, and that's clearly linked to NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Colombia just a little, mm-hmm. and the idea of alliances with them, the fact that we've given them a couple $1 billion for ostensibly stomping out drugs.
Right.
But you mentioned in passing about its abysmal human rights record in general, mm-hmm. and specifically towards union organizers.
Right.
Now, many of the people listening to this station are union members, probably much higher percentage than in the country at large. So we kind of always think that other countries are kind of violent, and it often goes right over our heads. But we're talking about something of quite a magnitude with Colombia.
Yeah, it's really striking. I mean, it's very, very difficult to organize. You think it's difficult to organize a union in the United States. It's very, very difficult to organize in Colombia, and you put your life at risk. There have been more trade unionists killed in Colombia than anywhere else in the world in the last 5 or 6 years. So it's a really shocking figure. And prosecution rates, investigation and prosecution rates, are practically nil. So, you're going around here, we're fighting about whether or not you should have card check for union recognition. In Colombia, you're taking your life in your hands trying to organize a union.
Now, one of the big organizing efforts, and that was stalled because so many unionists were assassinated, and some of them tortured and then assassinated, was against Coca-Cola.
And
maybe if you could just briefly, Jeff Thale, tell that story, because it was also brought home to the Coca-Cola headquarters as well.
That's right. The Coke workers had a contract, and I'm not going to remember the exact year.
But in Colombia, I think we have to say Coca-Cola, not Coke.
Right, Coca-Cola, yeah, that's correct, yes. The Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Colombia, which is an affiliate of Coca-Cola headquartered in Atlanta, its bottling plant had a union. The union had been there for some time. The union sought to negotiate a new and better contract. And in the course of those extensive negotiations and a strike and a series of labor disputes, union leaders and union, members and negotiations committee activists were harassed and threatened and killed. And the trade unions in Colombia called for international labor solidarity, and there was an international boycott of Coke. Coca-Cola in the United States first claimed that they had no responsibility. It was an independent bottling company and not a formal subsidiary. after a lot of back and forth, Coca-Cola in the United States met with some of the boycott committee, put some pressure on Coca-Cola in Colombia. The strike was settled, but there's still no serious investigations of the trade unions or convictions of people, other trade unionists who were killed there.
Greg Thale, we just have about 4 minutes left, and people have said sometimes, all you do, Pete, is present negative stuff. Well, you'll be pleased to know that maybe it's all I present is negative stuff, but other people have offer solutions and ones that are realizable that take into account our national interests, but also that we have national interests that aren't at the expense of other people.
Right.
So the Washington Office of Latin America has a number of recommended courses of action for, certainly not for this president, but for... hopefully a new one that'll be more receptive to what you're suggesting. Give us a few of them or the highlights of them.
Sure. Not just in Latin America, but kind of around the world, U.S. credibility and the U.S. image after the war in Iraq is lower than it's ever been. And if you look at polls and what they say about how people see the United States, our influence is seriously, seriously diminished. And so a new administration has to rethink. If it's interested in having some influence on the rest of the world, it's got to rethink how we approach it. So in Latin America, we recommend four things. First of all, it's a different tone. You know, forever we've treated Latin America as our backyard, since the Monroe Doctrine. We can ignore them when we want. We can tell them what to do when we want. But we don't treat them, with a few exceptions. We have never treated the countries of Latin America as our partners and our equals. So the first thing we ought to do is take a different tone. And then the second thing we ought to do is the United States is frequently tempted to look at Latin America and say, it's us against the Cubans or us against Chavez or us against the communists. And I think what's probably important to see in Latin America today is what's driving politics there is poverty. You know, there are more poor people in Latin America as a percentage of the population than anywhere else in the world. And inequality.
Is that true even more so than Africa and Asia?
In terms of percentage of the population,
really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And if you look at inequality in Latin America is the most severe. The range from the lowest paid to the highest paid is more severe in Latin America than anywhere else in the world. And so it's not a surprise that there's a lot of movement for political change, and there's a lot of political pressure about that. And it's no surprise, on the other side, there's a lot of crime and insecurity. And so we ought to recognize that instead of seeing the big problem in Latin America as Chavez or the Mexicans crossing our border or drugs, what drives things there is poverty. And if we want to deal with some of these other things, we ought to be helping Latin American governments deal with the really severe problems of poverty they have. And if we do that, some of these other things will fall into place and be much more manageable kind of issues. So so we recommend a new president ought to take a trip to the region to indicate our interest and make a series of speeches there, ought to relook at our foreign aid package and whether it actually makes a difference in reducing inequality in Latin America. Ought to relook at our whole drug strategy, which hasn't done much to reduce the availability or the price of drugs in Latin America, and probably focus more on dealing with demand at home than trying to burn up poppy crops or coca crops in Mexico or Colombia. And then there's a series of kind of more symbolic steps, including re-examine NAFTA. And relook at our trade strategy, and then finally take some symbolic steps like ending our kind of foolish and outdated embargo against Cuba.
Now, we've been told that a lot of these countries are our enemies, particularly Cuba, particularly Venezuela, to some extent Nicaragua, and now with the reemergence of Daniel Ortega. Do they represent a threat to us?
No, I don't think they represent a serious threat to us at all. I mean, if you look at Venezuela, like, you know, you pointed out, Venezuela sells us 7% of our oil. On the other side, we buy about 60% of Venezuela's oil. So our two countries are tied together. They might want to cut us off, but they can't. And we might want to cut them off, but we can't. And so, no, they're not a threat. They're an annoying relative we've got to figure out how to live with. Because, you know, that's really what's going on here. And could we figure out how to live with them? The answer is clearly yes. We want to complain about some of the things we don't like, and we don't want to fall in love with them. But we can certainly live with them and deal with them, and that's always been the case.
Well, I think that's extraordinarily important. Well, Jeff Thale, thanks for spending your time with us. Greg Thale is the program director for the Washington Office on Latin America. That's WOLA.org. And if we just whetted your appetite for all these subjects, if you go to the WOLA site, there's an incredible number of resources there and links, and it'll give you a lot broader idea of what's going on south of our border. Well, Jeff Thale, thank you so much for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
This is WRIM.com.
Hello. How are you?
Hey, it's you and Mike. And Friday morning, we talk with John Cook, who's written an incredible article for Radar Magazine on Scientology. Very disturbing at times and downright funny at others.
It's a paramilitary organization in a lot of ways. The staff is. I mean, it's important to remember there are two different kinds of Scientologists. There's staff and then there's public. Public are the people like Greta Van Susteren. They're basically people who pay money and take courses and use it to help their lives.
Self-help crap, right? Like sort of a self-help.
Right. But then there's the staff, and those people are actually, they live in collective, housing. They work 24 hours a day for Scientology. Their lives are dominated by the church. They're totally in it. And those people live in a sort of paramilitary organization. The Sea Org is the most elite one, and they get paid like nothing. They get paid $50, $60 a week. But they do like close order drilling, turn left, right, that kind of stuff.
And one of the people you talked to that really gave you a lot of that information was David Miscavige's niece.
Mm.
And I thought she was explaining all that stuff they went through that you just said.
Mm.
But she also said how absurd it was doing it when you're 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing short of child labor what she was exposed to. She's a third generation Scientologist. Her parents were, her father is David Miscavige's brother, who's David Miscavige is the current head of the church and sort of best friend of Tom Cruise, and so her parents were staff, and they lived in this environment. And from the ages of 6 to 12, she was living at a boarding school. Her parents were about 10 or 15 miles away. She saw her parents maybe once a month, and she was doing literally hauling rocks, planting trees, digging ditches from age 6 to 12, and doing this kind of close order drilling stuff. It's astonishing that they would treat children this way, but there were other people that.
The Motor City's rock flamethrower, broadcasting from a spare bedroom somewhere inside Manoogian Mansion. Oh man, what a mess! Hey, somebody pull a navigator up to the back door, please.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. Whatever. This is 101 WRIF, the WRIF HD1 Detroit, the real rare.